Welcome everybody. I know for a fact that some people have already indicated perhaps they can do that formally, yeah, so that we note their apologies. Honorable Swart?
Thank you, Chair. Just my apologies. I need to go to the Chief Whip's Forum at 10 o'clock, and I'm hoping to join you after that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madon?
Chair, just an apology, please, from Eric Murray. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Honourable members, let us start immediately with the first presentation. We've got a couple of things. There are three of them. Three of them. And we're supposed to end at around 3. I mean around 13 hours at 1 o'clock. Then perhaps if we can get the first one from the Secretary.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to be very fast. The presentation we're going to make is this one of committees, the engine of Parliament. I'm going to quickly go through the general rules that govern the portfolio committees in terms of how they do their work and how they operate. Firstly, that the committees of Parliament are an extension of the House, which is the National Assembly, because that's where we report. So the work that we do as a portfolio committee, we're doing it on behalf of the National Assembly as a full House. Then we report to the National Assembly to adopt our report. So our powers are derived from Section 55 of the National Assembly Rules, which empowers the National Assembly as a legislative engine of Parliament. The National Assembly may consider pass. Must I use this?
Yes.
Okay. It says the National Assembly may pass, amend, or reject any legislation before the Assembly, initiate or prepare legislation except money bills. Secondly, it says the National Assembly must provide mechanisms to ensure the executive organs of states in the national sphere of government are accountable to it, to maintain oversight of the exercise of national executive authority, including the implementation of legislation of any organ of state. The general powers of the committees of Parliament, which are derived from those ones of the National Assembly. The first one is that, informed by the Constitution and the rules of the National Assembly, the committee may summon any person to appear before it and give evidence under oath or affirmation or produce any document, any person under the sun. It receives petitions from members of the public, representations, submissions from interested persons or institutions or organizations. Permit oral evidence or petitions on petitions, representations, submissions, and any other matter before the committee. Conduct public hearings. Consult any assembly or council, committee or subcommittee on any joint committee or subcommittee. Determine its own working environment and arrangement. We might meet at any venue determined by it, which is a committee, which may be a venue beyond the seat of Parliament. So we can meet formally as a committee, decide that today we're going to meet in Johannesburg, or we're going to meet at Spain. So when a committee meets at any point, anywhere in the, whether it's on oversight or whatever, it's still a formal proceedings of Parliament. And the rules of the committee are the ones that take precedence, whether it doesn't matter where we meet. We might meet on any day at any time, including on a day which is not a working day, which is a Saturday or a Sunday, on a day which the Assembly is not sitting. It means we cannot necessarily sit on the day when the plenary is sitting. At a time when the Assembly is sitting, subject to approval by the, in this case, the Chief Whip of the Majority Party and the House Chairperson, or during recess when it's constituency period. We can exercise any other power assigned to the committee by the Constitution, legislation, or any other provisions or rules of the Assembly. In terms of the portfolio committee on public enterprises, it oversees the Department of Public Enterprises and listed owned enterprises. This is a distinctive mandate of the committee. That the Department of Public Enterprises is not responsible for legislation, which is policy. That is the responsibility of policy department, which means that the Department of Energy is responsible for the policy for ESCOM. The Department of Minerals and Energy, actually, is responsible for ALEXCO, which is mining. SAFCOL, its policy department, is forestry and fisheries and agriculture. And then SAA, the Aviation Act, and all those transport regulations, they are governed by the Department of Transport. They are policy departments. So all like Transnet also, the policy department for transport is the Department of Transport. So the department has not initiated legislation in the last year since it became a department. It was only meant to be shareholder management. So the department has got a distinct responsibility, which is the shareholder management department. It means they are just acting as a shareholder on behalf of the people of South Africa and the government of South Africa. The committee uses different instruments to hold, in terms of oversight and accountability, the committee uses different instruments to hold the executive accountable, which is the same as what that is through the budget vote process and the strategic plans. It means the committee is able to scrutinize the strategic plans and see if they are in line with what the government of the day wants to achieve, if they are in line with the developmental objectives of government, and also the budget, in terms of how the department has been engaging, implementing this budget, and whether the budget is in line with the strategic plans. Second case is the budgetary review and recommendations report, which is a report that is a midterm report on the portfolio committee, of the portfolio committee, on how the committee has spent its budget for the last 6 months and what is it that it has implemented over the last 6 months. To do that particular report, we look at the oversight reports, we look at the quarterly reports of the department, we also look at the briefings that they give us every day in terms of what is the department is doing. Is the department performing according to what we have approved as a committee in terms of their budget vote and the recommendations we have made? So we also, through the budgetary review report, we assess what is that they have done to deal with the issues of the Auditor General's recommendations on their financial statements in the last financial year. What is that they have done in terms of looking at the audit findings and the recommendations of the committee in terms of the budget vote, which is done in February. And this BRRR report is done in October, which is 6 months down the line. So they are all interlinked. The annual and the quarterly performance reports, this is how the committee also does its oversight, because this is where the department and entities will report in terms of how far are they in terms of implementing their things. Oversight visits of state-owned enterprises. That is also how the committee actually goes and see what is that the departments are doing and how the state-owned enterprises are actually functioning. Particularly that the state-owned enterprises are responsible for building infrastructure in the country and ensuring that there is economic development and economic growth ultimately. We also do that through legislation and through petitions, as it has been as part of our mandate, that thing. And then secondly, attendance for committee meetings. Rule N, the NA rule 185, it says that a member of the assembly who is not a member of the committee or subcommittee may be present at a meeting of the committee or subcommittee. A member mentioned in sub-rule 1, which is any member of the assembly who is present at a meeting of a committee, may speak on any matter before the committee or subcommittee, subject to any reasonable restrictions the chairperson may impose, may not accept when the vote is cast as an alternate in terms of rule 156. It means that the committee's got 11 members. The ANC's got 6 members. The 7th member is an alternate member. The opposition has got 5 members. The 6th member is an alternate member. So it means at any point, even if there's 13 members inside here, all members can participate in debate. But when it comes to voting, only 5 members of opposition can vote. Only 6 members of the ANC can vote. The vote must come to 11. In the absence of one member of the ANC, an alternate member of the ANC, which is any member of the assembly, can come and vote. same applies to in the opposition. If there are five, if one opposition member is not available, any member of the opposition from the minority parties can come and participate and vote to make it five. That's what the rules are. If I go to number 11, quorums and decisions. The committee. A committee at all times requires to have at least one-third of its members present to do its conduct its business. It means that when a portfolio committee sits, one-third of the members must be present. One-third is what, four, right? Yeah, for 11, I think one-third would be four. Of the members must be present. It means when the department is sitting here or an entity, there must be four members present in the meeting. So that at least the meeting must be of status that it can be called a meeting. A majority of members of the members of a committee must be present for it to decide on a question, on any question, which in our case it would be six, which is 50% plus one, for us to make any decision as a committee. An alternate may vote if the permanent member is absent. I've dealt with that part. When a committee has to decide on a question and a quorum in terms of sub-rule 2 is not present, the chairperson may either suspend the business of a quorum until a quorum is present or adjourn the meeting. The chairperson may co-opt any other member of the National Assembly from the same party or act as a member of the committee until a committee member of the or alternate member is no longer absent. That is the, it speaks the same to the issue of the quorum earlier. In terms of public involvement, Section 59 of the Constitution and the NA Rule 170, it says committees must ensure public involvement in accordance with the provisions of the Constitution and these rules. It means when we do our, when we have meetings, the public is allowed in our meetings. When we do oversight, the public is allowed, the public including the media, in all matters of the committee. Public participation in terms of sub-rule 1 is subject to and must be exercised in accordance with applicable reasonable measures. And must be exercised in accordance with applicable provisions of these rules. The public has access to all official notices to members and to all documents tabled in the council, which is in this case the National Assembly, subject to reasonable measures taken by the chairperson of the council to regulate such access in a manner consistent with the national views. Closed meetings. These are rules that subject the committee in terms of under what circumstances can a committee deal with a closed meeting. These rules, NA Rule 184, 185, 186, 187, they actually say that the committee must meet at the beginning of the committee meeting. The committee must discuss the matter that is before it and then take a resolution in terms of the matter, whether it is of a nature where the committee needs to meet in closed doors and the matters need to be reasonable. I will make one example. When you were dealing with an inquiry on ESCOM, the committee would meet without the public to discuss the names of people that they are going to invite. But because there were threats on the people that were going to be invited, the committee took a resolution that when we discuss the people who are going to invite, we're not going to call the media. When we took the decision, the media was available, was here. So the media understood the reasonability of the decision. So the media did not find that we are infringing on their constitutional rights to be part of the meeting. So it is in the past we used to, the committees would sit under closed doors, they would just apply to the house chairperson and the chief whip, then the chief whip says, no, that meeting must be closed. Then we are taken to court. So now it doesn't happen that way. The committee must sit and discuss those reasons in front of everybody. Then based on those reasons, all parties must agree that indeed there is reasonability on this particular one. We can close the meeting. Then the media is asked on those basis to this. That's how it ended. I'm not going to deal with the issue of the legislation, Because I understand that the committee, the members were done, were taken through during the induction. But also because our committee at this point in time has not been mandated, is not mandated in terms of policy to oversee the thing. But as and when with the shareholder management period comes, we will go through and we will give procedural advice on the legislation in terms of how we'll go about processing for the legislation. We'll also get legal advice from our parliamentary legal services in terms of how to process legislation. But otherwise, that is the process in terms of how do we process legislation on the slides that are that follows there. I will not go into detail on those slides because they just speak about how does Parliament do legislation. If it's fine with you, Chairperson, I can stop at that one, at that red one by then. Okay. I've still got 10 minutes. I think I can, for 10 minutes, I can go to the legacy report. Next. The legacy report is this one. This document. It's very thick. I'm not going to go into detail like I went on this particular one. Yes. The legacy report of the Portfolio Commission Public Enterprises. Basically, on the first page, it does reflect on what happened in that particular fifth parliament. That indeed, we did have a strategic plan at the beginning. In the strategic plan, the committee was able to identify its own modus operandi in terms of how it's going to do oversight, what will be its key objectives, and what will be its mandate for that thing. The mandate is generic for all NEA committee things, but specifically for the Portfolio Commission Public Enterprises, on page 2, we identified the focus areas. And then we have identified all of them there. We have listed what were the focus areas for the committee on that particular day, on that particular term, and what is that the committee did. So we have listed all that on page 2. And then which goes to page 3. It is basically a synopsis of one of the key things that the committee did. And then the key areas of work, which is number 3. We've also made, on page 4, we've made recommendations in terms of what is it that the sixth parliament committee could look at. But this is not casting stones and this is not binding. A legacy report is only to inform the committee in terms of what is it that that fifth parliament was doing, so the committee can understand the historical issues of what has been there and what has been the historical challenges and what the department and state enterprises have been doing to address those challenges. So this is quite extensive. And then on page 6, we deal with key emerging challenges that the researcher will be dealing with those issues in his in a presentation in terms of each entity, what his mandate is, what are the challenges and things like those, and the content advisor. But also on page 8, we deal with recommendations for the committee. The recommendations, like I said, they are not binding on this sixth parliament. The sixth parliament decides on its own objectives, its own focus areas, and what is that what to do. But this one is just to inform you in terms of what is it that was the challenges that were held in the last. So the introduction. These are the companies. These are the companies. This is the department that we have overseen. Page 10 deals with the entities and its mandates, which the researcher will go into detail regarding those entities. And then the method of work of the committee on page 11, 1.3, it just says that the committee basically had meetings with committees on briefings, but also they had joint meetings with different portfolio committees. On a matter that relates to a policy relation issue, we would meet necessarily with portfolio committee on transport. If there's an issue of a regulation that is hampering the success of FAA, the committees that they would have, sister committees, we call them sister committees, they would meet together and ensure that they address the issue together. If it's a matter related to demand and it's got to do with the policy, we meet with the portfolio committee of defense to see how we can, the two committees can work together. It's really just cooperative governance and it is being encouraged that committees must work together. And also, the chairperson is the one who's responsible to ensure that he ensures that the work of the committee is realized by ensuring that he oversees the support staff that is being given to the committee, that we're able to ensure that your recommendations are implemented. We do follow up on behalf of the committee and report back to the committee. So the chairperson is that there. And then the chairperson would have what he calls a management committee. That it is not a mandatory committee. That means it is not necessarily a statutory committee, but it has the committee, the chairperson managing staff of the committee. The purpose of this report basically is, like we said, is just to give a report of what the first parliament was doing. Then I will not go necessarily into the key statistics of what the committee had done. I will go to page, let me see, I want to do what things that the researcher will not, and the panel member will not be dealing with. Yeah, this is just a report, this is now what you call activity report, in terms of they have gone on oversight, they have gone on this day, they have gone to SAA, those were recommendations, the responses to the recommendations and things like those. That is what the tables are dealing with. And then the one of the things that didn't happen in that five years, we have never gone on a study tour as a portfolio committee. So the study tour must be a priority lead. And then international agreement on page 2, we don't deal with international agreements also. Nothing has been sent to us because we don't deal with policy. So international agreements have got to do with policies that are governing the different departments. And then they make, when the Department of International Relations goes, and or Department of Transport, they sign agreements with other countries. Those agreements are sent to the policy department, because our committee does not deal with that. Our committee deals more on the impact of the state-owned enterprises on the economy, in terms of the developmental objectives, job creation, skills development, beneficiation, support to local small medium enterprises. So that we are more on the impact of the state-owned enterprise in the economy, but also on the governance in terms of ensuring that money that government has put on the entities is used efficiently and effectively. There's no corruption, there's no malfeasance and all those other things. So the government, we've got a twin task, looking at impact, but also looking at governance. We look at the impact of the money that have been sent, that are being spent by entities on the ground, on the people. Then we also look at the governance issues in terms of the finances. And then I think I will end at that chapter, because the rest of the report basically deals with activities and what has been achieved by the committee in the last. And it is a reference document that the committee can use as we do oversight.
Okay. Thank you.
30 minutes.
Yeah. I think that is the first presentation by the committee secretary. Can we engage it or perhaps participate? Let me start with the Honourable Madone.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chair, I'm a bit of a stickler for the rules, as everyone knows. It's my job in the DA. I'm the rules whip, rules and legislation. So the rules that guide committees are very important to me, because I think that often we don't actually, as a committee, understand what we're allowed to do. And part of the legacy report, which I see isn't there, was a section that I submitted about other members coming to this portfolio committee and speaking and using it as a platform when they're not even members of this committee and they had no idea what we were doing. And Chair, I'm going to be very blunt about it. We have times that you will see you cannot come into this room for the amount of media that is here, because we're dealing with something that's in the public domain and of public interest, like Eskom or Denel or something like that. Chair, and then what happens is news gets around Parliament that this committee is dealing with something that's high profile. And the next thing, you've got 6 or 7 members of another party arriving. Not one of them are even alternative members on this committee. And then they're demanding the right to speak. Now, Chair, the rules of committees and that guide committees, when we sat down and we redrafted the rules, which we accepted during the fifth parliament, one of the things was it was at the discretion of the chairperson always who he would allow to speak if they were not a member or if they were not an alternate. And I fully understand, because I've gone to committees that I've had an interest in, and I've introduced myself to the chairperson and I've asked permission of the chairperson to speak, because I think that that's the polite and correct thing to do. But what we had is we literally had an ambush of people from other political parties simply because the cameras were on. And literally, Chair, if I can put it bluntly, 6 members of the ANC would speak, 2 members of the DA would speak, and then 24 members of smaller parties would speak, completely outweighing proportionally the kind of speaking time that should be allowed in a committee. And I don't think that's fair. And I'm 100% in favor of proportional representativity, and I fight very hard for it. And anyone who sits on the programming committee knows that I fight for extra time for smaller parties to talk in Parliament. But I do think that what's fair is fair. And especially if we're working on something that's very intricate and very detailed. And Chair, as I said before, this committee is not about politics. This committee is about being Team One South Africa. I mean, we're all here for South Africa. We're not here for our political party. It throws us completely off our game, because there are going to be times when, as Desang said, we close the meetings so that people don't know what this committee is doing, because otherwise people would literally flee the country or you know, that kind of thing. So, Chair, I'd really like to encourage us. It's Rule 156 in the rules of the National Assembly that deal with the committee, just for your noting. And that deals with who the alternates are. And then, Chair, for your reference, and I'm sure you've been trained in this already, but not everyone here knows, Rule 185 deals with the presence of other members, and it details exactly what kind of powers you have. Now, Chair, I don't want a situation where the chairperson of my committee is being bullied and we just sit quietly and don't assist, because I know what it's like. Then all of a sudden you look like the bad guy because you don't want people talking or, you know, going too far in the committee. And I think that going forward we must have the guts and the determination, when someone is disobeying the rules of Parliament, that we must back our chairperson up. And I for one found that I was guilty of not doing that in previous terms. I didn't stand up for our chairperson enough when we happened to have 2 women at the time, and they were being bullied by smaller parties. And while everyone has the right to speak, Chair, we must certainly make sure that that we obey the rules of Parliament. Chair, then another interesting thing that happens in this committee especially is regards the behaviour of some of the media. And I say some of the media because they are serial offenders. Now, most of the media that come to this committee are serious journalists. We're very, very lucky. We have the top journalists in our country who take interest in this committee. Chair, but what we can't have and what we can't allow is, while we are in the middle of a discussion, for a journalist or even someone from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group to come in, walk in front of you, put a microphone down in front of you, and completely throw you off your train of thought. And we've had chair people actually having to say to members, listen, you can't do that. People are busy talking, they're in the middle of a presentation, or they're in the middle of a questioning an entity. So, Chair, I strongly encourage us to just keep an eye on that too, because it's these little things that over time, when they continue to happen, and especially, Chair, I think as a committee we must be alive to the fact that we're going to deal with some very harsh things. And we mustn't be afraid to say, look, you are so welcome to be here, and we are delighted that you are here, but you cannot intrude on the work that we are trying to do. And, Chair, I often find that recording devices are put down in front of members. And those recording devices are important, because then you get quoted verbatim or whatever the case is. But, Chair, I don't want that recording device sitting there while we're having our break, and a member says to me something that's in confidence, and it's being recorded on a recording device, which has happened twice. I don't think that's. I just think it's protocol that we need to follow, because we need to respect one another and certainly respect the media. And then, Chair, if you'll allow me my last point, we often meet in venues that are too small. And I speak from experience, as you know, and the son nods his head. We have often been put in, my personal pet hate is the room in the old assembly chamber upstairs that actually seats about 9 people. And then we have a meeting where Danelle will come and tell us about the salaries. Now, a meeting like that, you've got about 20 people from Danelle, you've got all of our committee, and then you've got about 30 people from the media. And everyone is cramped in a room where people are actually standing behind you. So there's people looking over your shoulder, you can't move. So, Chair, this is an important committee. In actual fact, I'd say this is one of the committee that is the engine room of the country's economy. And I think we have every right to demand that we have a meeting room that's big enough for our purposes. And I think that we have to give the secretariat of our committee the necessary support, if required, to demand that we are accommodated in a big enough venue. Because for too many years, Chair, we've been putting venues that simply weren't big enough for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Mkwal.
Thanks, Chair. I hope I can miss my short short word. Thanks, Chair.
You do have. You don't have to strain yourself. There's a mic in front of you.
It's big, like me. Chair, my question before the discussion, I wanted to question. I know that maybe I will bring everybody back, but it is better for me to question whatever here, if you can allow me.
Okay.
I think it's on page 6 of the first presentation, the Indian Room of Parliament. The presenter, the secretary talked about the first bullet is the committee oversees the Department of Public Enterprise and its state-owned companies. Yes, I understand that. But what is our role as this committee on the coming shareholders management bid? Like you said, it was not done before. We have never had the document done before. But also, pairing that with the committee resolution, the last meeting, where we said it is important for this portfolio committee to fast track the bid. So, if I can get a clarity around that and the processes going forward to that. But also, Chair, on page 11, maybe I will have to reread my as my colleague, honourable member, was going to say, in Rule 185 for this a point 2 of public involvement. My worry there, Chair, was exactly part of what honourable member Mosley raised to say. What is it that we have as a committee, and in particular you, Chair, to have the control of the number and the influx? Because sometimes it is really some issues need to be discussed by the members. Again, we are selected to be members of the particular committee to deal with particular issues. What is it that we can use? Is there any rule that can protect us from that? Observing from the distance of what was happening here, it's really, we really need to find a way of of protecting ourselves and of course of protecting the chair, as Honorable Monsen said, but for me to protect the work of the committee itself. For me, that should be my take for now, Chair.
Good.
Thanks, Chair. We have said we are not responsible for legislation. How do we interact with its formulation? Because I've got a feeling that it's so critical that we tend to be governed by something that we are not part of, right? And secondly, I've seen when you were saying that there are sister committees, right? Can we make it mandatory at least that we have certain times that we make it mandatory that at least once a year, twice a year, or whatever time, we do meet with them rather than be a kind of being optional? So those are my two comments.
You got it?
Yeah.
Let me go to you before I take the other. You've got
three minutes.
You've got you're all the counts, including the comments, if you see a need.
Okay. Yeah. No, I think the first point by Honorable Mazoni regarding the issue of the members insisting and bulldozing their powers on the chairperson, because we have seen the chairperson sometimes they get insulted. If because there's rule says any member of the National Assembly can speak, ne? But the chairperson must put restrictions. It means the chairperson in making the, putting the restrictions, he puts time allocation in line with proportion. So if, for example, a members of one political party, if, for example, the political party is supposed to have only one person in the meeting, and then you have been giving members 3 minutes to speak, so it doesn't necessarily mean that if all four members, you're supposed to have one, but there are four, they all four want to speak, it means you must probably say that I'm going to give you to speak, but I can only give you 6 minutes, or it means you must reduce the minutes, even if they speak, but the minutes are very important. So we use the time allocation to ensure that you regulate members speaking in the meeting and ensure that even if they wanted to speak, but there's a time allocation to how the members speak. And then the issue of the interference of the media is a very important thing. I've noted it so that as and when our meetings take place during that time, we're able to also announce that they must not interfere. And then we will gladly welcome the intervention on the venues. SCOPA doesn't go through the process that we go through. They've got priority, they have been given priority for venues. It's SCOPA, it's the finance committees, like appropriation, finance. So it's something that must be dealt with also at the WIPS forums and whatever. So that they must understand the kind of challenge, because Ms. Mazon is correct that we always have a problem of venues because they don't prioritize our committees. But this committee has always been like the matters that we deal with are very controversial at the most times. So they generate a lot of interest from the public. The shareholder management bill, the role of the committee in this particular matter is that the shareholder management bill has been coming for 10 years almost, because the President Zuma established the PRC, the Presidential Review Committee, in 2010. They had a report. The report says that there must be an overarching legislation that empowers the department to govern. At this point in time, the department does not have any legislation that empowers them to govern. They only use the Companies Act and the PFMA, the National Treasury Resolution. So that thing, when it comes, definitely it will come probably to our committee, but we're hoping it will come in this financial year. But it might come in the next financial year also, because there are many things that have been coming for a long time, but in the APP, they said it's going to come probably the end of the financial year or next financial year. I think it says next financial year in the APP, not this financial year. Then our recommendation says no, actually it must be fast-tracked to this financial year. But actually, that it's supposed to come to our committee, because our committee is going to do with shareholder management. And then the protecting of members, I'm going to ask the chairperson just to clarify me on the question on how do we protect members?
The question is how do we control the influx?
Now, through the chair, I think part of what you have answered answered my question on the restrictions.
On the restrictions, okay. And then in the issue of the how do we interact with the formulation of this? I can tell you, I was telling the chairperson that when the portfolio concentration industry made change regulation on governance of state-owned enterprises and put them on a different schedule, the portfolio company public purpose was never invited to the hearings. The minister then was Malus Gigaba. The minister just came and said, from now on, we are calling them state-owned companies, not state-owned enterprises. But for us as a committee, we did not understand what was the thinking behind why from state-owned enterprises to state-owned companies, things like those. So, because we were not part of that particular process. So I think it's a very important thing. And then the structures of parliament are the ones that can deal with this, like the WIPS forums, the NA rules committees, because sometimes they make rules that portfolio committees will run with legislation that impacts on our committees, but they don't invite us. That is how our interaction with those. That is why I accept that it must be mandatory that we must meet and we must write to these committees. And when we go for a strategic plan as a committee, it should be things that we put down and then we write to the committees that this is how we're going to operate as a committee. And then I think I've answered the question, Chairperson.
Okay. Is there any last bites before we step down from this presentation? Anyone want to? Okay. By the way, we have been going through that process.
Yeah, I'm also a timekeeper.
Okay. Okay. Let's go to the next presentation.
Chairperson, you can also interact.
No, I understand. Okay. The researcher. Ms. Brownwell, you think that you are right there, or you want to remove the slide?
No, I'm fine. Yeah.
You find it. Okay, you see everybody.
Yes.
Okay. Then kick.
Okay, I'll be doing an overview of the Department of Public Enterprises and the state-owned companies. So slide 2 is a presentation. I think it's in your packet. Oh, that one that you have on top. That one?
This one?
Yes. Okay, so page 2 is just the contents page, so we'll just be going over the mandate of the Department of Public Enterprises and then through each of the SOCs and what their challenges are. So on page 3, just gives an overview of the aim and the mission of public enterprises. The aim is to drive investment, productivity, and transformation in the department's portfolio of state-owned companies, their customers and suppliers to unlock growth, drive industrialization, create jobs, and develop skills. And then the mission of the department is to provide decisive strategic direction to the SOC so that their businesses are aligned with the national growth strategy arising out of the national development plan. On slide 4, just look at the National Development Plan and what it says regarding our department. The department's overall mandate is to ensure that the SOC's business portfolio are directed to serve government strategic objectives as outlined in the NDP, as stated already. And through its mandate, the department contributes to the NDP's objectives of outcome 4, which is decent employment through inclusive economic growth, and outcome 6, an efficient, competitive, and responsive economic infrastructure network. So it's basically jobs and infrastructure. Then with regards to the medium-term strategic framework, what it says regarding us is to initiate reforms to restore good governance and financial stability at public institutions and state-owned companies, and also to develop and implement an infrastructure program which includes continuing with the program to build, revamp, and maintain electricity infrastructure, including generation, distribution, and reticulation to ensure sufficiency and sustainability of supply and development of alternative energy sources. So this one just speaks about electricity, but there is other infrastructure with regards to the transport and the railways and everything. And then on slide 6, with regards to the medium-term budget policy statement, This gives us a series of urgent economic reforms needed to build a more competitive economy. So like the Sun said, the state-owned companies drives our economy by creating jobs and creating infrastructure. So they also need the reforms to be competitive. So point two says it includes reforming the SOCs, governance of SOCs, rationalizing state holdings and encouraging private sector participation, requires most major economic infrastructure investments to be financed on the strength of the balance sheets of SOCs, and support to state-owned companies will depend on the sound and sustainable business cases and on strengthening internal governance. So this is basically what government aims to do with the SOCs. It's still in the process of trying to do these things. Okay, and then on slide 7, it just gives an overview of the departmental structure of the department. So you have the minister, the deputy minister, and then the director general. And then under the director general, there are three programs. Program 1 is administration. Program 2 is SOC governance, assurance, and performance. And program 3 is the business enhancement, transformation, and industrialization program. And then under each of these programs, you have more sub-programs. But we'll speak to that on the next slide. So on slide 8, as I mentioned, there's three programs, and then under each of these programs there's more sub-programs. But the most important one that we will probably look at is program 3, business enhancement and industrialization, because these are the ones that actually do the service delivery. So under these you have sub-programs, business enhancement services, energy resources, which has the responsibility of oversight of ESCOM, ELEXCO, and SAFCO. You have the research and economic modeling program, sub-program, and then you have the program of transport and defense, which has oversight over the Transnet, SAA, SAX, and DANAL. The budget for the department for this financial year for 1920 is $293 million. The staff complement is aimed at 232 staff, and then the challenges facing the program at the moment is the finalization of the shareholder management bill, as the Sun says, that has been coming on for a very long time and we still haven't seen anything regarding this. We don't know which way they're thinking of going with regards to this, and also effective oversight of the SOCs, because SOCs have not been improving, let's just say that. So they need to improve on the oversight with regards to the SOCs, the department. Okay, that's with regards to the department. Then with regards to the SOC mandate, on page slide 9, the department does not directly execute programs but seeks to leverage the state ownership in the economy to support the delivery of key outcomes outlined in the NDP. So what this means is that the department itself, they don't actually do anything, they only provide oversight over the SOC. So they themselves don't implement any programs themselves. They oversee the SOCs that implement the specific programs. So then the department has oversight over ELEXCO, DANAL, ESCOM, SAFCOAL, which is the South African Forestry Company, South African Airways, South African Express Airways, and Transnet. So SAA was given back to us at the end of 2018. Or end of last 2017. ELEXCO. So we'll go through the state-owned companies in alphabetical order. So ELEXCO. ELEXCO was established in terms of the ELEXCO Limited Act of 1992 and amended in 2001. It is 100% owned by government. Its core business is the mining of land and alluvial diamonds. So alluvial diamonds is just diamonds that you find in the sea. It's focused predominantly on the Richtersveld area on the west coast of South Africa, and the land mining is undertaken by the pooling and sharing joint venture, while ELEXCO has the marine mining rights. I'll explain that last sentence in more detail. Okay, ELEXCO's day-to-day activities include exploration, mining. As I said, the land is undertaken by the PSJV, and the marine is undertaken by the IMDSA, which is just an acronym for the International Mining and Dredging South Africa. It's just a company that has the boats that does the marine mining. Then they also have diamond cutting and polishing through the preferred service provider, SSI. There's also a story behind SSI. I'll get to that also later under the challenges. And then they also do land rehabilitation. So the revenue for the last financial year, which was 17-18, was 209 million, and they had an operating loss of 13.9 million, which is due to high operating expenses. And then the 2017-18, they had an unqualified opinion with matters of emphasis. So unqualified means that basically they had a good everything the auditors found, didn't find anything serious, so it was a good outcome. And then with just matters of emphasis means that there's just issues that they need to take into account for the next audit of the audit outcome. Okay. That's a repeat of what I just did. Okay, page 13. So on slide 13, I'm going to speak about some of the history that was with regards to Alex Gore, especially with the deed of settlement, the DOS. You'll hear a lot about that with regards to Alex Gore. So the Richtersveld community successfully initiated a land claim against Alex Gore, which resulted in the deed of settlement signed in 2007. So the outcome of this land claim settlement impacted on the company's mining and non-mining operations, as the settlement agreed, amongst other things, the following. All land and buildings subject to the land claim would be transferred to the Richtersveld Communal Property Association, the CPA. Certain urban and erected buildings within the to-be-established township of Alexander Bay will be transferred to various social institutions and government authorities to normalize the social and government structures. And then the land mining rights would be transferred to the Richtersveld Mining Company, the RMC, 49%, while the company will retain its marine mining rights at 51%. So on slide 14, the deed of settlement also requires Alex Gore to exit its 51% equity holding in the PSJV in a socially responsible manner. So they need to basically give that 51% over to the community as well. Alex Gore was required to establish a formal township in Alexander Bay. So before this deed of settlement, there was no Alexander Bay really. So that's created Alexander Bay as a municipality, as part of the municipality, which included the upgrade of all municipal services to meet the municipal standards, that is roads, stormwater, sewerage, and reticulation networks, and all the other associated things that the municipality has to take care of. The transfer of severance properties to the community, and also requires that all overdue historic rehabilitation responsibilities remain the responsibility of Alex Gore. So basically what the rehabilitation refers to is when you do mining activities, obviously they dig holes and they do move around all the earth and stuff like that. So when they're done mining, they need to rehabilitate that area to the way it was before they did the mining. So that's what that refers to. So on the next slide, it just gives you an overview of the organizational structure of Alex Gore. So this is the part that's the 51% owned. So you have the board, you have the CEO, and then under the CEO you have the CFO, the Chief Operating Officer, the Chief Supply Chain Manager, and then you have the Head of Legal Services, and then all these other activities underneath. So with regards to the challenges of Alex Gore, I'll just try to highlight the main challenges. There are lots of challenges, but these are the main ones. So the deed of settlement requires transfer of the residential properties to the community, as was stated. So the parties agreed, the community with Alex Gore, that Alex Gore would lease the properties for a period of 10 years. So the properties that Alex Gore was supposed to give back to the community, Alex Gore would lease for a period of 10 years. They further agreed that $45 million would be paid upfront to the Richtersveld Property Holdings Company for Alex Gore to retain the right of occupation. So the challenge with regards to, so you might have heard that the $45 million issue always comes up. The challenge with this is that the property holding company was laying dormant and the entity was not properly constituted. So the money that Alex Gore needs to pay over, the entity that the money should go into was laying dormant, and also the entity itself was not properly constituted. So it wasn't put together properly, it wasn't, the people didn't nominate the various people that are supposed to be in this company correctly. So they agreed to pay the money, so they've met with the community and then and DPE got involved. So now they've agreed that they will pay the money directly to the 3,000 beneficiaries that lives in the area, Alexander Bay, but this requires a court order as it differs from what is required by the deed of settlement. The deed of settlement says that money must be paid to the community structure, but now, because that community structure is a difficult thing putting it together properly, so now they agreed that the money would go directly to the beneficiaries, but now that is in counter to what the deed of settlement says. So now they have to go to court to get the change of the deed of settlement, and that in itself is a long process. Another challenge is that there's a lot of infighting in the community. There's different structures. So you have the CPA, which is the Communal Property Association. So you have that structure, and then, but now there's two of that structures. So one is being supported by certain members of the community, and then there's another one that's saying that that one is not the right one, there's a different one that the people selected. So there's a lot of infighting, and the communities are, some support Alex Core, some don't like Alex Core. There's a lot of different stories you hear all the time. Then there's another issue regarding the longevity of Alex Core operations. There's always different information. If you speak to the community will tell you there's a lot of diamonds in the sea. There's a lot of diamonds in the sea. They will still be able to mine for the next 20, 50 years. But according to Alex Core, this diamond is running out. The longevity is only about 10 years, so they must start looking at different other businesses to go into. So that's why they want to move away from mining and start looking at coal. Coal was one of the businesses they wanted to go into, start mining coal for Eskom. But that was put on hold by the minister. But that is one of the reasons why they want to do that, because they're saying there's no more mine, there's no more diamonds. But like I said, there's differing opinions on that. Then the next challenge is financial challenges. Like I said, there's two entities, the PSJV and there's Alex Core. So all the work is undertaken by the PSJV, and then they split the money the way it should, 51% and 49%, but all the work's been done in the PSJV. So what happened a couple of years ago, or I think 2 years ago, is that the boat that was doing the diamond mining burnt out. So they couldn't do a lot of the Louisville diamonds, so they only did the land diamonds. So that meant their revenue went down, because they were only restricted to the land, and they get more money for the Louisville because the diamonds are better in the for the Louisville mining. So and then that caused like a lot of financial challenges, and also there's just financial challenges, I think, for the management, and also who they give there's always issues regarding supply chain. The supply chain issues, there's always issues regarding that. And then the allegations of maladministration. Now, I spoke about the SSI, which is the diamond marketing partner. So what happens is when they get the diamonds, what happens is they give it to their marketing partner, which is the SSI, which is Scarlet Sky Investments, and then they sell it to, they put it like in categories and then they sell it on. So what the community or what the people are saying is that since they've given their diamonds to SSI to sell, their revenue has gone down because the amount of money that they're getting is below market that the SSI is selling it for. And also, there's been allegations that SSI is linked to the Guptas through Salim Issa. They say it's one of these companies, and that's why the revenue that they're receiving is less, because they're not selling it at par at market rates. So that's one of the allegations. So it will be in the annual report, but the minister has instructed them to have an investigation with regards to that issue. So we haven't really received any feedback on that as yet. But okay, yes, check.
Check, can I just have a two finger on that?
Okay.
Because our researcher can't, she's politically bound by what she can say. The fact of the matter is this committee found that SSI was linked, and when we did the ESCOM inquiry, one of the booklets that we got was the State Capture Bible, which we used, and that company is directly linked to two of the Gupta brothers. And what Leanne means when she says that the diamonds are sold below par, there's three indexes that are used around the world to determine the price of raw diamonds.
Mm.
And if you take, for example, the Bloomberg Index, that's the one that's used the most widely across the world for raw diamonds, because you must remember they take the diamonds out of the ground and then they measure them by kilograms, because they're not cut yet. So you take a chance when you bid on them. But Bloomberg has them at 60 points higher than Alex Kaur sold it to SSI. So in other words, the lowest international standard, which is Bloomberg, is 60 points more than we sell our diamonds to SSI. And that's why they're running at a loss. So Alex Kaur came, and the chairperson of Alex Kaur has also been linked to state capture and will appear at Zondo Commission. So it's, and Leanne can't say this because she's not a politician, she sticks to... So I'm just giving you the background of what happened in the committee. So the chairperson was asked to leave the committee because the Zondo Commission was going to call her to appear. The minister also asked her to, you know...
The chair of the...
Of
Board. Oh, board.
No, I understand.
There are a lot of chairs.
Yeah,
I mean, this one is of the board.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there were links there. But the main thing is, every Thursday, there's a bidding process that happens. I think it happens at the Johannesburg Diamond Exchange. So Alex Kaur sends up maybe, say, 10 kilos of diamonds. And we sell them to SSI at 60 points below market average. That means that South Africa, we're losing 60% profit compared to the rest of the world. And then the second thing that we must keep in mind is that Alex Kaur told us that the diamonds are drying up. We know that the private share company of Alex Kaur has found pink diamonds, because alluvial diamonds, that's the diamonds in the sea, they come out blue or pink or yellow, they're the rare diamonds. And they've just had a massive haul of pink diamonds, because what happens is the Orange River flows down into that particular area. And because the Orange River has red sand, the diamonds come out pink. And pink diamonds are worth an absolute fortune. So Alex Kaur has always been like the stepchild of public enterprises, because it's always been on the sidelines.
Okay.
But now Alex Kaur actually has the ability to provide an enormous amount of money to South Africa in terms of just if we sell the diamonds correctly and if we mine the diamonds correctly.
Okay, can I also ask a question on that? Is that state of the situation in terms of our pricing or selling of the diamond currently is still continuing as in that six down?
Chair, it was one of the agreements just before we finished the sixth parliament. So when we finished the fifth parliament, the very last meeting we had, we instructed the minister instructed an investigation to take place into the pricing of how Alex Kaur prices their raw diamond pricing. Because you must remember, those are uncut diamonds, so they're called raw diamonds. So when Alex Kaur came before us, they were pricing 60 points below, and the minister asked for an investigation.
Therefore, where we are seated now...
We're waiting for that investigation.
We are still waiting.
Yeah.
The situation possibly still...
Yes, possibly still status quo.
Okay. Okay, continue.
I'm worried about the time frames of this investigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man.
Because the more we extend it, the more we wait, the more
we are drawing it down further.
Have you set up the time frames, or it was just...
Che, once again, I'm sorry to step on Leanne's toes, but she can't tell you this because it was political. The minister was in charge of setting up that investigation. So our committee asked the minister. Yeah, because we don't have direct oversight over this. So we asked the minister, as the stakeholder, that investigation must be done as a matter of urgency. Just so that you know, because I don't want you to think that we were derelict in the previous parliament. To get to Alex Kaur is so difficult that you actually fly into Namibia and then you drive from Namibia to Alex Kaur, because if you point at the very top of South Africa on the west coast...
I was exactly about to ask where is this place.
Yeah, so you point right to the border of Namibia and there's a place called Port Nalis.
Yeah.
And Alex Kaur is there. And when you get there, Chair, this committee will go. You'll be so horrified. it looks like a nuclear wasteland. Everything is grey. Because before, well, not before, but together with Alex Corp, De Beers was mining that area. And that's why Leanne speaks about the... Lee speaks about the rehabilitation. Because it looks like mining, it looks like concrete mining dumps. So we've destroyed the ecosystem, we've destroyed the marine life system, so they have to regenerate all of that. But that's why this committee is so difficult for us to get there, because if we drive, it takes like 17 and a half hours to drive there, and alternatively we have to charter a flight where we fly to Namibia and then cross the Namibian border to get to Alex Corp. So we weren't being derelict, we were actually being, we didn't want fruitful and wasteful expenditure, that's why we got Alex Corp to come to us.
Okay. No more, continue.
Okay, you have to understand that I only have half an hour, so I can't go very in depth into all of them, because then we'll be here all day and tomorrow.
Sorry.
No problem. Okay. The next slide 18, is okay, that was the now. We're going on, I mean, Alex, we're going on to the now. So the now is also another long story, so I'm trying to keep it short. So the now, as overview, is a commercially driven company and strategic partner for the innovative defense, security, aerospace, and related technology solutions. So basically, they a defense company that makes defense equipment. The now provides turnkey solutions of defense equipment to its clients by designing, developing, integrating, and supporting artillery, munitions, missiles, aerostructures, aircraft maintenance, unmanned aerial vehicle systems. So if you see UAVs, they're talking about this, unmanned aerial vehicle systems, and optical payloads based on high-end technology. When you go to the NAL, you'll be very impressed with all these things. Revenue for the 17-18 financial year, it's unaudited because they haven't submitted their 17-18 financials yet. So revenue of $5 billion for 17-18 with a loss of $1.8 billion, as it says, unaudited figures. So the 17-18 annual financial statements was not submitted to Parliament because they also have been going concern issues. And then the 16-17 audit, they received an unqualified opinion with findings on its irregular expenditure. So again, the auditor said that they were fine, just with finding on the irregular expenditure. And then they have a staff complement of approximately 5,000 permanent and fixed-term contractors. And on the next slide, it's a bit hazy, but I'm going to go into it in a little bit. It's the overview of the organizational structure. So on the, if you're looking at it on your left-hand side, it says Minister of Public Enterprises, and then below that, DENAL Board of Directors, and then the DENAL SOC Limited. So under DENAL, they have a few divisions. So, okay, it's DENAL Aeronautics is the first one, so that's aviation. And the DENAL Technical Academy, that falls under that one. And then the next one is the DENAL Dynamics, which is the UAVs and they have space tech. The next one over is the DENAL Land Systems, and then they have the DENAL Vehicle Systems, and the last one is the DENAL Aerostructures. Okay, they've got quite a few entities. And then they also have associated companies, which is on the far right-hand side. And then they have at the bottom is their strategic equity partners. So the strategic equity partners is where they are involved in a company, but to a lesser extent, so they'll hold 49% of the company shares. And why they do this is so that they can get the technical know-how. So they don't want to own the company, but they want to be able to send their people there to get the skills so that they can create their own business. So it's basically for skills and knowledge transfer. That's why they have these strategic partners. Okay, we go to the next slide. So this is the challenges. So between 2011 and 2017, the company was consistently recording profits. They were on a good trajectory. They had an order book of over $18 billion. Okay, and then the next, I'll just put this here so that you can understand a bit of denials and how they work. So due to the nature of the defense industry, denial needs upfront capital to begin manufacturing, with payment only flowing once targets have been met. So they have like different key gates which they have to meet, and then once they meet those targets, then they get like tranches of payments. So without this, denial cannot meet its obligations. So that's why they need a big upfront capital so that they can start producing, so that they can show the client that they are capable of doing this. And then once they meet their first target, then they start getting the money. And then once the production starts going, but they first need the upfront the capital to do it. So then I put the Denel Asia saga damaged the company's reputation. So the Denel Asia saga is basically when Denel created an entity called Denel Asia, which was registered as a company in Hong Kong, and they did this under the pretext that they needed that company to be able to have access to the Asian defense market. So in that part of the world, they were saying, because in the rest of the world, the money spent on defense is declining, but in the Asian market, the revenue being spent on defense is increasing. So to gain access to that market, they created this Denel Asia. But now,
what was it doing exactly?
Nothing. I'm still explaining. So
can you?
Yeah, I'm going to explain. So basically, Denel Asia, that was the pretext. It was that they were going to make this company, and this company was going to get contracts, business on that side of the world, and then they were going to lease the IP from Denel itself, and then Denel Asia was going to sell it on or something. That was the pretext. So what happened with this Denel Asia, why it became an issue, is because it didn't receive any of the necessary approvals that is required. So they needed to get approval from the Minister of Public Enterprises, which they did not get. They needed to get approval from National Treasury, which they did not get. So they gave the excuse that in the PMFMA, they said, if you don't get the response within 30 days from Treasury with regards to a certain issue, you can take it as approval has been granted. But the issue was that they submitted the application in December. I think it was the 11th of December, which everybody knows, everybody's going on holiday and everybody's on leave. And then by January, this entity was already in existence. So everybody, and even the minister, I think she also wasn't even aware of this being created. And I think it was like retrospect approval was given to cover the tracks and stuff. But anyway.
Were involved in the driving of that?
Again, we can't get involved in the politics.
Okay.
Denel Asia was established by a company called VR Laser. VR Laser is a Gupta Links affiliate, and Salim Issa was the director. It was a postbox company that was established in Hong Kong that we found out per chance that they'd established this postbox company. Denel already had a massive footprint, especially in the Middle East, and Denel, so what they were doing, IP stands for intellectual property, and basically what was happening was VR Laser was going to use Denel's IP, take a section of the profit for VR Laser, and then take a section of profit for Denel. And when it was found out that this was done, it was stopped immediately, but given the fact that it had gone so far throughout the company, it created the reputational damage that he speaks about, but it was basically because Denel Asia was established by VR Laser.
So that was the reputational damage that caused the reputational damage.
Okay. Sorry.
I understand. It's the second time. Now, Honorable Member Muslim was to say the researcher can't get in his politics. But, Chair, please, excuse me, what is the purpose of this session?
No, the purpose of this session is to induct us.
Yes.
On this state-owned enterprise, where we are now. In fact, we're dealing with the department of which you presented, and now we're going to each and every company.
Thank you, Chair. But I understand the department has all this information, including the political facts that Member Mazon has.
Yeah.
Let me ask the question, say, of a layman. What if Honourable Member Bazwani is not in committee? So which means the way information that was not going to be given to us, raw as it is, because I think one of the tasks of the committee is to get whatever it is, raw as it is, from the officials that have the information, and it's up to this committee to deal with those issues. I think there must not be the information that we don't get. I don't think, with all due respect, Chair, it is not her information, eh? Is not her report. Is the report that is in the department. So that information is not given to us.
No, I don't think she doesn't give. She does give us. But the only caution that she has as a staff, she doesn't want to go to those areas of political partiality and so on. She's just trying to. Honorable Mazone, as a politician, she goes into those details.
Follow up, Chair. That's my point to say, because that information, that's what Honorable Mazone is serving, is in the department. It's the information that is in the department that the previous committee had. It must be given to us with whoever. The question that I'm raising is, what if we don't have the previous member? Mm-hmm. Which means we're not going to get this raw information, if you can call that. We can never get that political information that you can exactly that. It's really my question, Chair, and I really...
Shabalala?
Thanks, Chair. The session today, the workshop, and in the workshop we're here to get, especially from the content, much as we can in the state of all these entities or companies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that our people that are training us get as much details as they can, specifically those thorny issues. You know, for us to move on from there, we need those type of things. So there's nothing prohibiting. We understand you're being pressed for time. I don't know why, because we don't have a sitting today.
Yeah.
Some of us have said we're available. I don't know why did we go for lunch. We'll be here until 6 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night, prepared to disrupt, because we want to really get into the ground of the crux of things, especially because you are in the state of capture. So that detail that Honorable Manzoni is talking about, that's what we are interested in, because then it will assist us. So we don't, there's nothing wrong for her to point it out, but it is important to also, when we get to discussion, after you've presented, then we can interact. She feel free to point out, well, feel free to also ask more, if you need more. But all I'm saying, I don't know, that didn't tell me why did we press them for time, because she's pressed for time. But she's more than capable of giving us. All I'm saying is that when you point them out, can you please give us those stony details, because that's what we're interested in, especially things that led us to the state of capture and as the proceeding goes, so that we are able, the workshop, the purpose at the end, we should be able to say we want, including, we can even change your program for next week, because I'm looking at it and I'm asking myself questions, why am I doing walkabout? These are serious issues. So this workshop must be in a position to say this is the way forward.
Honourable members, please, before, I think she is doing well. I don't think there is any information that she doesn't give us here. You know, it's just a question of choice of words, and I think she is doing well for that. She won't be changed. She won't change to be Lee and be Mazoni. You know, just please bear with her on that one.
I'm just very emotional and excited about, you know, this committee taking on the work that we did last time. So maybe I should keep quiet, and I will.
Then we interject.
But Chair, what I strongly suggest, and I would ask Lee to make available, is we had the Bible of state capture. which was a book that each member of this committee got. It was produced by a group of experts who had studied state capture, and it helped us tremendously. There are still copies of that book available. If Leo by any chance doesn't have it, I've still got my copy, and I'd be happy to have that photocopied. Mm. And Chair, that particular book shows the linkage of each company to each person, and who was in VR Laser, who was in this one, who was in that one. And I think it's essential going forward for this committee to get a full understanding that they are provided with that particular document. It was the document put together by the university. And I lost my train of thought. Hold on. That book. I'm sorry, Chair, I've lost my train of thought. But that book, Chair, is essential for this committee.
Continue, Ms. Brownwell.
Sorry, I do apologize, I'm not providing enough detail. I was just thinking of doing a generic overview, and then when we meet the entities, I was going to put everything in the brief that you get before the meeting, so that all the finer detail would be in those briefs. But I'll try to be a bit more detailed.
Sorry.
No problem. Okay, so on slide 21, the challenges with the now continued. The quality challenges, as I was saying, they need a lot of upfront cash available to start. And they are at the moment suppliers withholding deliveries due to delayed payments. And this has all got to do with the reputational damage, I think, because I think a lot of the contracts that they had have been cancelled now due to this, their reputational damage and their governance issues. So if they don't have a lot of governance, if your governance is not good, a lot of people don't want to contract with you. And then a second point is the entering into loss-making contracts. There's been also another issue was that the previous CEO bought a smaller company that was making vehicles. And then when the new board, he was let go, usually contract wasn't renewed, and when the new board came in, they said that he bought this company that wasn't, they never had the money for him to buy in the first place. Mm. But that begs the question, the previous board obviously gave approval for him to buy the company in the first place. So where was the approval? So there's also issues regarding them buying this company, and now that they're in a loss-making position, they say it's due to this company being bought. But that again goes to the governance issues. Where was the approval? Who said they could buy it? Because a CEO can't just buy a company without the board's approval, or even the minister's approval. Then that leads to the governance challenges that we've spoken about. As Ms. Mazzoni said, the previous board that was brought in had some challenges, issues, I'll say it like that, but they've been replaced now. Government support, at the moment they have government support for the total guarantee facility of $3.43 billion, which is expired in 2023. So they needed the support to be able to pay contracts and to pay workers. Now, Chief, if you haven't seen the newspaper articles, that Solidarity, the union, the Denal union, is taking Denal to court because they say they haven't paid SARS, the UIF, and the taxes that were deducted from the people's salaries. And Denal is also having issues regarding the paying of salaries because they don't have enough cash available. And that's why they need those government guarantees. And then there's also government's also speaking about the option of a strategic equity partner for Denal as well to create better efficiencies within the company and to have better financial management as well. Okay, that was Denal. And then slide 22 is Eskom. So Eskom was established in terms of the Eskom Conversion Act of 2001. It generates, transmits, and distributes electricity to industrial, mining, commercial, agricultural, and residential customers and redistributors. Yeah. So the redistributors is basically the municipalities and the people that sell the electricity for them on Eskom's behalf. Then for, this is current, the annual report is out for 2018-19. So the revenue for 2018-19 is $180 billion. With a profit before depreciation and amortization of $31.5 billion. but they have a total overall loss for the year, which is after the taxes and everything, of 20.7 billion. So, and they have, their sales volumes have decreased by 1.8%, basically 2%. Okay, in slide 23, the total assets of Eskom is 758 billion, and debt and borrowings of 440 billion. So that's both current and long term, the debt and borrowings. The municipal debt plus interest is basically 20 billion, and the Soweto debt is basically 14 billion. And their payment level is basically the amount of people that are paying, so it's at the level of 12.5%. So of everybody in Soweto, only 12.5% of residents are paying Eskom. Eskom has a staff complement of 46,665, which was at March 2019. That's both permanent and fixed-term contracts. And then for 2018-19, they got the qualified audit opinion with findings and emphasis of matter. So they've got qualified audit opinions for the last 3 years, since 2016-17. So basically what a qualified audit opinion means is that the auditors could not verify certain information. There was not a trail, there was not a paper trail for the auditors to verify certain information. So that's why they got a qualified audit with findings. So slide 24 is basically a organizational structure of Eskom. So you will see, if you look at the annual report, they talk about Eskom Group and Eskom Company. So the group is everything, everybody. So Eskom Holdings, you have Eskom Enterprises, ESCAP, Eskom Finance Company, and Eskom Development Foundation. So basically what we look at most of the time is Eskom Enterprises, because that's the one that does the electricity distribution. Okay, I'm going on to slide 25. So Eskom challenges. Okay, so they have aging fleet. So basically aging fleet means that their power stations is more than half of their life year span is already over. So basically they have like over 30 years if power stations is getting old, it's requiring more maintenance. As they get older, you need more maintenance. So some of the challenges is inadequate maintenance and breakdowns because of the aging fleet, which leads to deterioration of plant performance. So that causes, what happens is the plants, they have planned and unplanned maintenance. So planned it obviously when they shut down, they know what's going to happen. In 3 months' time, we're going to shut this one down and we're going to maintain that one. And then when that one's done, we're going to do the next one, But what happens sometimes is when you plan to do one and you're busy with that one, another one unexpectedly trips or something happens, and then it causes loss in power. So that's what happens when we have load shedding, is when there's lots of unplanned breakdowns and the amount of electricity available goes down dramatically and does can't meet demand, then they force rotational load shedding, basically what happens. They also have a challenge of underinvestment, so in the mines and in the plants. So in the mines, what happens is usually a plant is associated with a mine, so the mine is built close to a power station, and then that mine specifically produces coal for that power station. That's what happened in the olden days, that's what they did. So they would say, okay, for so many years we're going to mine this shaft, and then after that we're going to have another shaft, and then we're going to buy additional land, and then we're going to mine on that land. But what's been happening because of the financial challenges, they haven't been investing in other shafts, and they haven't been buying more land for that mine, company to make the drop another shaft and to build more coal. So what's happening now is they're going deeper and deeper and deeper, and the quality of the coal is getting less and less and less, and it's not the quality of coal that should be burnt at that specific station. So the burn factor that you get is high, but the quality of the electricity that you're getting is less, because the coal is not producing the amount of electricity that you want, because you're using inferior coal. So that's another challenge. So that's what they did first when I say underinvestment. They're not investing in the mines, and they're not investing in the coal quality that they should be getting. So also what I'm speaking about, back in the olden days, when they used to have a mine associated to a station, power station, now because the associated mine can't produce the quality of coal, they're going onto short-term contracts with other coal miners, which they have to transport the coal into the power station. So that's also when they talk about the different coal contracts. You have the long-term contracts, which is with the associated mine, and the short-term is when they contract in from different mines. It's not, it doesn't produce specifically for Eskom. They're just a coal mine that maybe produces coal and exports it, and then Eskom goes to them and says, we need more coal, and then they get it from, they buy it like on short-term contracts, and then they take it to their station and use it. And that quality, another problem with the coal is that because India and all of them are also now using lots of coal, we have export quality coal. So the mines are using that, the quality of coal that Eskom requires the same as what has been exported. So because also the companies get better money for the exporting of coal than from Eskom, they export it. They would prefer to export the coal than to give it to Eskom. So that's also causing a lot of issues with the coal for Eskom, because now Eskom has to compete with the prices that they're paying internationally for the coal. Okay, and then the second one is delays in commissioning of the new power stations, Medupi and Kusili. So Medupi and Kusili was planned to be finished a while back, and they're still being in the commissioning stages. So in the when they were building Medupi and Kusili, there was issues with the build itself. Some of the way that the things were built was inferior, so they had to redo it. And also now that once the power station, some of the units are being commissioned, they're finding more design flaws in the designs, and now they just go back and correct it as well, which also puts pressure on the system, because they need to, the ones that are producing, they need to stop them so they can fix the, make the errors correct. And then the third issue is the reduction in sales, low tariff increases, reduction in revenue, and they cannot cover increasing costs of primary energy, mainly coal. So as I'm saying with the coal, because they're exporting coal and their own mines are not producing the quality of coal that they want, they're getting coal from other coal mining companies. So the price of coal is increasing for them, because if the export coal goes up, and other price of coal goes up as well. So reduction in sales is because of the rotational load shedding, people have gone off grid. So a lot of people are not buying electricity from Eskom anymore. They're either like investing in their own green electricity or generators, but the sales, that's affecting the sales of Eskom. And then low tariff increases. The electricity tariff is regulated by NERSA, the National Electricity Regulator of South Africa. So they regulate the prices of electricity that Eskom can sell the electricity at. So what Eskom has been advocating is that they want a tariff that is cost-reflective. So that means that they must get revenue that covers their costs. That's what they want, a tariff that's cost-reflective. But because our electricity has been so cheap historically, getting the prices now to be cost-effective is not going to be economically, let's just say that people won't want it, because it's going to be a quick increase over a short period of time, and they can't adjust for that. It's going to affect a lot of Eskom's customers, especially if you, the large energy users, they also, they are saying that the government needs to intervene in the electricity tariff increases, because the companies that use a lot of electricity, that's their main expense, especially the mines. They use a lot of electricity. So if most of their cost is going to go to electricity, it's going to affect the bottom lines, and then it's going to affect the mining industry as a whole. So there's this trade-off between what Eskom wants, which is cost-reflective tariffs, and how that high tariff is, in a short period of time, is going to affect the economy. especially businesses and the people that use a lot of electricity. So there's a trade-off in that. So NERSA is allowing them increases, but at a very slow rate, and it's also not what ESCOM wants. ESCOM wants more cost-reflective, and NERSA is not granting them cost-reflective. They haven't even granted them basically inflation-related at this point in time. So that is also putting pressure on ESCOM's finances, that they're not getting the enough revenue to cover their expenses as well, which is putting them, which is forcing them to go with the debt route. So that's why the debt is high, so that they can cover their business. So it's a lot of interaction between different issues. Then the fourth point is the introduction of renewable energy impacting on the business. So like I said, because of the load shedding, well, not because, before the load shedding, the government introduced renewable energy through the independent power producers, so the IPPs. So that is also because now there's more competition. There's more competition of who creates, because before ESCOM was a monopoly, they're the only ones who generated electricity. Now you have the IPPs, which is also generating electricity. And according to the latest information, IPPs is the cheapest form of electricity compared to coal. But because ESCOM you have to go through ESCOM to sell your electricity. So the IPPs are forced to go through ESCOM to sell on the electricity. And according to ESCOM, the IPPs is more expensive than the coal. But that is through ESCOM. So at the moment, there's still a very big debate of which is cheaper, the IPPs or coal at the moment. So that is another. But it's impacting on ESCOM's business. Because IPPs are forced to go through ESCOM. ESCOM are basically forced to take that electricity from the IPPs because it's a Department of Energy thing. So they have to. They're basically forced to take the IPPs. Okay, and then the last point on that slide is ESCOM business structures in question due to changes in the sector and economy. So like I said, ESCOM is at the moment a monopoly with a few IPPs. So because in the rest of the world, there's more competition within electricity, the way ESCOM is structured, it's not in line with the way that the energy sector is moving. So that's why a couple of years ago they introduced the ESMO goal, which was the independent system and market operator, which basically wanted to separate the three, like they're suggesting at the moment, separate the three into the generation, the distribution and transmission, so everybody's separate. So basically what would happen is that there could be a lot of generators of electricity. They would sell it on to the distributors, and then the distributor would then decide how they're going to sell it on to transmission. And then it would actually create more competition, because obviously the ideal would be that they would take the cheapest electricity first and sell that on before taking the more expensive one. That would be the idea. So that would also create a more transparent tariff, electricity tariff, a cheaper electricity tariff, because now there's more competition. So it will create more businesses in the long run for South Africa, so it would make it more efficient. And then business wouldn't pay so much high tariffs. It would create up more space in the economy for more businesses. Mining would start over again because people are not investing in mining anymore because it's getting expensive. So the idea is a good idea. It's just about how to do it. So that's the business structure in question of ESCOM. And then on slide 26, the situation worsened by weak governance, mismanagement, and lack of internal controls and governance processes and unstable leadership. So, okay, I think everybody followed what happened with regards to ESCOM's governance, and the leadership kept on changing and people got suspended and there was a lot of CEOs in rotation. So hopefully now it's more stable, it would lead to better stable leadership and a better governance environment. Then the second point is the debt servicing costs and operating expenditure increasing while revenue has declined. So it's again what I spoke to about before. Because the revenue is declining and because the tariff is not cost reflective, they've not been able to cover the cost, they've been forced to take on debt, not just to cover the infrastructure build, but to cover the operating expenditure as well, because the primary costs of coal and to generate electricity are rising. So now that's everything rising, but the revenue has been declining. So that's why they have forced to take on debt. But now the debt is rising and the interest is rising, and they're getting no money. So that's where they are at this point in time. Then thirdly is the lack of clarity in the energy sector. The integrated resource plan has not been finalized and there's no clarity on the energy mix for South Africa going forward. So basically on the energy section, in the energy sector, there's the integrated resource plan, which is supposed to be updated I think every 2 years, but ours hasn't been updated since 2011. So what this plan is supposed to say is supposed to say that in South Africa, we are going to have, so the energy mix refers to, we're going to have so much energy created by coal, so much created by nuclear, so much by, like 20% by nuclear, 30% by wind, so many by sun, basically tells you that. So this plan in itself has not been updated since 2011. So we're waiting for this plan to be updated and approved so that Eskom can make the proper investments, because they don't want to invest in something now, like say another coal or another wind or something, and then in the energy plan it says we're only going to have a limited amount of that. So that's what we're waiting for, and a lot of, I think the whole country is waiting for that at the moment. It's still not finalized. And then this has all led to credit rating downgrades. So because of the status of Eskom, and now that they've got the qualified audit reports, the credit rating has also been downgraded. They're also in line with the sovereign, but they had their own credit rating that was above the sovereign. But now because of what's happening within Eskom, their governance issues, their qualified audit opinions, the credit ratings have downgraded them, and because they've downgraded them, it's even made it more difficult for them to access debt, to access loans, and to access funding external to government. So that's why now they're forced to go to government, because they're not able to raise funding on their own strength anymore and in their own balance sheet. So that's most of the challenges with Eskom.
Okay.
Chair, I'm sorry, but in good consciousness, I can't keep quiet as much as I want to. Chair, just to explain the rotational blackouts that we experience, which is colloquially known as load shedding. Eskom has to keep what they call a base load, which is a minimum amount of electricity that we have available to anyone in the country. So what happens is, for example, we import electricity from Mozambique, from Cahora Bassa. If that line goes down, then our base load tips below. So imagine the base load is here, and as soon as our energy peak starts going below that base load, we have to start implementing rotational load shedding. And that happens, Chair, if our international imports go down, like Cahora Bassa, or if what we import from Kariba Dam, which is now going to be a problem because Kariba Dam is at its lowest level ever. Chair, and also if the coal gets wet in Mpumalanga and they can't burn the coal. So what we have to know is that Eskom can't maintain the base load of electricity, and that's why we're going to load shedding. Chair, just so that this committee can get an understanding, Eskom has 46,000 employees. A company that is the closest in size to Eskom is Kenyan Electricity. They have a workforce of 13,000 people in comparison to 46,000 people at Eskom. So that gives you an idea why we keep saying that the staff is overinflated at Eskom. In 2011, there were 30 middle managers, At the moment at ESCOM, they're still trying to work out, but they know that it's somewhere between 300 and 700 middle managers. So they inflated the middle management at ESCOM, and that's what led to the biggest crisis. Chair, with the Madhu people, they're 8 years behind schedule, and at last check, it was about 18 billion rand over budget. And Chair, the biggest problem facing Madhupi, and this committee is going to have to face, is the fact that Madhupi has been commissioned without what they call a gas desulfurization fleet. And that means that when the electricity is burnt, the emissions that go out into the air are absolutely toxic. So it could cause loss of life to the community in that area. It's already poisoning the water. Kusile has got a gas desulfurization fleet. Chair, to add it now is going to cost an extra 18 billion rand. So that is a big, big concern that we have for ESCOM. Chair, NERSA, the reason NERSA won't grant the tariff increases is quite simple. In South Africa, ESCOM has been supplying electricity to different people on different levels. So, for example, there are very big companies. One used to be called BHB Billiton, which I'm sure we all know about. It's now changed its name to Southern Rice Smelting. They smelt aluminium. Chair, while we were paying, for example, 82 cents per megawatt hour, BHB Billiton had signed a contract with ESCOM that gave them 18 cents an hour. So there is such a disparity between how much we pay for electricity versus how much big business pay for electricity. It's why NERSA cannot grant the tariff increases that are required. And then, Chair, in terms of the coal that we're burning, Chair, Madhupi and Kusile were built to burn literally ash. They were built to burn the lowest grade quality coal we have. What happened is that the people doing the tests on the coal were summarily fired. The one person died, and there has been a huge controversy around how we check the coal quality that's being sourced for our coal stations. But Chair, I'll just leave it there, but these are concerns that this committee has to address, because even President Ramaphosa said the single biggest risk to our country's economy is ESCOM.
Shabalala?
So I'm just suggesting on the program that can we stick to the program and allow presentation to continue. The program says there's time for discussions. Then we go to discussions with a tea break. Can we give a chance to finish presenting? Then we can discuss, not to inform or anything, but discuss.
Okay, can you continue?
Okay, thanks. On slide 27 is on SAFCO. So SAFCO is established in terms of the Management of State Forests Act of 1992. Government forestry company, which conducts timber harvesting, timber processing and related activities, both domestically and regionally. It manages 10.5% of forests in South Africa, operates in Mpumalanga, Limpopo and KwaZulu-Natal, and they have 189,768 hectares of plantations. And Inflomo in Mozambique manages 82,574 hectares. So basically Inflomo is a subsidiary of SAFCOL that also forms part of SAFCOL. So on Inflomo, it's a Portuguese word, so you excuse me, I won't say what we'll call it in Floma. Slide 28, so the total area under management is 272,307 hectares, and as business offerings include commercial management of forest plantations, logs and timber, and ecotourism. The revenue for the last financial year was 926 million and had an operating loss of 136 million. With a net loss of 80 million. And they received a qualified audit opinion with findings. So basically, again, the auditors couldn't verify certain information with regards to the paper trail that was left by SAFCOL. So basically, they don't have sufficient evidence to support some of the information that they were giving to the auditors. So here on slide 29, you can see the organizational structure of SAFCOL. So you have SAFCOL, and then the main business of SAFCOL is called Kamatiland. But basically SAFCOL, they're the ones, they implement
implementers of SAFCOL, and then you have Inflomo, which they own 80% of, which is in Mozambique. The other entities are mostly dormant. They don't undertake any activity. Okay, then on slide 50, we have the SAFCOL challenges. So, SAFCOL mostly operates in a rural environment, so they're in the plantations in the rural areas, so that's why government keeps them under DPE, because they create employment opportunities in the rural environments. That's their main business, is to create jobs in the rural environment. So some of the challenges are depressed log and lumber market conditions, which basically has an effect on what they can sell and what their revenue is. Then the mismanagement, weak governance processes and internal control and leadership instability, similar to the other issues with regards to the SOCs, is the weak governance processes. They don't have sufficient policies, and or they might have the policies in place, but it's not being adhered to. So some of them still have some of the supply chain issues as well. Then they had Inflomo, which is the Mozambique arm of SAFCOL, was under care and maintenance. So basically what this means was that they weren't conducting any business. They were just maintaining the trees. They were just making sure that there was no fires. They weren't conducting any business. So what the business means is that they weren't cutting down any trees. They weren't creating any logs. They weren't selling anything. They were just maintaining it, to make sure that the trees were maintained. And that was due because Inflomo wasn't making a lot of good business, so they kept it under care maintenance until they could come up with a plan for Inflomo that would put it back on track as a going concern. It's been an integral part of the business. So now it's been taken out of care and maintenance and been put into operational performance. So one of the main issues with regards to SAFCOL is that they themselves acknowledge, and DPE acknowledges, that they're not meeting its full potential, because they're just cutting the logs and they're making the logs and selling it on where they could beneficiate the logs, where they can make furniture, they could branch out into other industries and create jobs in that way. So a diversification strategy, and also which includes exporting, which they haven't fully implemented. If you look at their last, the 2018 financials, they also admit in the annual report that they haven't properly implemented this strategy. Okay, and I see they're employing in the rural areas, and then one of the main challenges with SAFCOL is that of land claims. 57% of the land that SAFCOL operates on are under land claims. So this makes sense, because they are in the rural areas. So because the land claims is not under their domain, it's under the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, is still called agriculture. Okay. But it's their responsibility to resolve the land claims, and because the land claims are taking so long, they have conflict with the communities, because the communities, obviously, they don't see government, they see SAFCOL that's occupying their land, and they want that land. But now, obviously, there's trees on that land, so what happens is the community sometimes burns down the trees or cuts down the trees, or they see vacant land, because what happens is when SAFCOL cuts down trees, they let some land lay fallow so that the soil can regenerate, so that they have unplanted areas. So what happens is the community sees this vacant land, and they want to go and take it over. But it's SAFCOL land, and then they have conflict with the community. So basically what SAFCOL needs to do is they go into the communities and they explain the process of why the land claims work, and it's not that they are holding the things back. It's obviously in a different government department, but they have interactions and they try to give jobs to the communities around them, so that they feel that the plants and that the trees are their own, and that they can explain to them that it's a benefit to them. So they also have, when the land claims are settled, they have a land settlement model, which is the lease back model, which is basically they lease back the land from the community and they pay the community. But I think that is under review now, because I think the minister said that they should involve the community more in what Safcall is doing and not just give them the money. They should try to give them jobs and make them feel more owners of the plantation. Okay, so that's Safcall. On slide 31, it's South African Airways. So South African Airways was established by the South African Airways Act 5 of 2007 and the South African National Air Carrier. It is mandated to provide a full suite of domestic and international services. It supports the development of the state by operating and growing new air links between South Africa and its major trade and tourism partners, and transformation, skills development, and job creation. It has four wholly owned subsidiaries, which is Mango, SAA Technical, Air Chefs, and South African Travel Center. So additionally, SAA has SAA Cargo and SAA Voyager. So the last annual report that they submitted to Parliament was the 2016-17 annual report, which was a qualified audit opinion. 2017-18 has still not been submitted, and this is again due to going concern issues. So basically, going concern issues just means that they can't, they don't have enough money to operate successfully. Then they had revenue for 2017 of 30.7. So these numbers that I have is from presentations that they came and presented, but it's not audited. It's not officially audited. It's basically unaudited numbers. So the revenue for 2017 was 30.7 billion, had operating costs of 33.5 billion, and operating loss of 2.8 billion, and had a loss for that year of 2017 of 5.6 billion. So they incurred losses for the past 12 years. And they have a staff complement as of 2017 of 5,275 employees. So on slide 53 is again an overview of the organizational structure. So you have SAA. I'm looking at the bottom left-hand side, SAA, and then you have the commercial operations and the cargo and the Voyager section. And then the subsidiaries, it's a technical, Mango, Airships, and SATC, which is the travel center. So the Airships, obviously, they provide the catering on the aeroplanes. SAA Technical is the maintenance and repair and overall business, so they look after the aircraft. And then Mango is the low cost carrier. And then SATC is the travel center for South African Airways. Okay, so slide 54 is the challenges with regards to SAA. I think everybody should be familiar, it's always in the news. So, firstly regarding the mismanagement and the ineffective governance processes and internal controls within the entity. They have unsustainable cost structure and high indebtedness. The fleet configuration is inappropriate, so that just means that the aircraft that they're flying is not appropriate for the routes and the number of people that they're flying. They have been implementing the long-term turnaround strategy for a very long time. And then they have a high level of competition, high fuel costs, and the fluctuation of exchange rate impacts on cost of the airline. So all this is affecting the day-to-day business. Okay, that's it for SAA. SAA Express is similar to the same situation as SAA. So SAA Express is a domestic and regional air carrier with a mandate to be an African airline. So SAA Express was originally envisioned to service the smaller airports and SAA to service the bigger airports. So SAA Express was to do the smaller airports and link up with the bigger airports so that SAA can then take them on international trips. So SAA would then do Port Elizabeth to Cape Town, and then SAA would do Cape Town to Dubai always. That was the vision strategy for this. One of its primary functions is to convey passengers from the smaller airports in the country to the larger airports and strengthen the network. Offering flights to most destinations in South Africa and some in the African countries as well. So both the 2016-17 and the 2017-18 annual financial statements are outstanding as well as it's also as going concern uncertainty. So the financial issues worsened as from the 2013-14 financial year, which when they also had governance issues. So similar to SAA, they also have unstable leadership. They also have aging fleets with high maintenance and lots of breakdowns, which impact on the operation and the revenue. Because obviously, if you don't have planes that can fly, you can't operate, which means you don't have revenue, so you don't have money coming in, because then people stop flying with you, which are unreliable. You have cash flow constraints and inability to raise cash due to a weak balance sheet. They have inadequate capital. So what both SAA and SAA Express said is when they were created, they weren't given appropriate capital to start off with. So that's what they're saying. They're saying it's historical and that they didn't have enough capital to start off with. So they started from a low base. And because they never had enough money in the beginning, it's now caused all this knock-on effects to where they are at this point in time. They have a lot of staff and critical skills. So because, like a lot of the pilots, and because they have their own SAA technical and SAX has their own technical staff, because of the uncertainty with regards to SAA and SAX, the people, the technical skills that is required to maintain the planes, because staff is uncertain of the future of these, they've been leaving, and a lot of the international consortiums and airlines have been taking them and off, making them job offers. So a lot of the critical skills, specifically within the technical units, have been leaving South Africa. They have high operating costs, again, with regards to fuel costs, maintenance, and the exchange rate fluctuations. And then, again, the mismanagement and ineffective governance processes and internal controls within the company. Okay, the last one is Transnet. So Transnet is wholly owned by state and a custodian of the Cantonese freight, railway, ports, and pipelines infrastructure. Its mandate is to assist in lowering the cost of doing business in South Africa, enabling economic growth, and ensuring security of supply by providing appropriate port, rail, and pipeline infrastructure in a cost-effective and efficient manner within acceptable benchmarks. So within acceptable benchmarks just means that it should be internationally, parity internationally, so that everything is in the same line. So revenue, as this was in the interim statement, so both Eskom and Transnet do interim statements. So if after 6 months, they will do an interim statement of how their financials are, and then they'll do also the final one at the end of the financial year. So in the interim report, they've reported they have 37.6 billion in revenue with the profit for the period of 2.8 billion. They have total assets of 365 billion and a borrowing, total borrowings of 130 billion. So on a much lower scale than Eskom. So Transnet, as of March 2018, has 55,666 employees, and they also received a qualified audit opinion in 2018 due to irregular expenditure. So again, irregular expenditure is basically expenditure that was undertaken not according to policy and without the due approvals and stuff like that. So the mandate is driven by the statement of strategic intent, which the minister gives them at the beginning of each year. And their strategic intent statement is that they need to provide cost competitive logistics, grow rail market share. So basically what this is, so they talk about the modal shift from road to rail. This is what this is. They want stuff to move away from the road and move onto rail so that it's more efficient and also the roads aren't less impacted. And also especially for greenhouse gases and stuff. They want to integrate SA with the region, the continent, and the rest of the world. So basically, outside South Africa as well. Leverage private sector investments in infrastructure and operations, and optimize sustainable social and environmental outcomes of all business activities. So on page 59, it's the organizational structure. So Transnet consists of the following activities. The Transnet Corporate Center, which is basically the administration arm, And then they have Transit Engineering, which is the engineering solutions to support rail and port operations. They have Transnet Freight Rail, which provides integrated rail transportation flow of various goods and commodities from inland customers to ports and from ports to inland customers. Pipelines is integrated rail and pipeline solution to ensure reliable and safe transportation of gas and petroleum products. So with this one, if you go to the Durban port, outside of Durban Harbour, there is a pipe there where the ship comes and they give the oil, they transfer the oil into this pipe, and then it goes with this pipe all the way to Johannesburg. So they maintain this transnet. And then they have National Ports Authority. It's the oversight of the total port system and logistics chain. So they're basically the ports authority is basically like NERSA, but for ports. And then they have port terminals, which is the effect of the flow of imports, exports, and transshipment through cargo terminals. So they're the ones that when the big ships with all the containers come in, they make sure that the ship is offloaded on time and within time, and they're not standing there for 3 to 4 hours taking off the containers and loading the containers and putting the containers in a cargo hold and all of that. That's their job for terminals. So Transnet also has two specialized units. They have a group capital, which just looks at the investment into capital. So it leads the execution of Transnet capital expenditure program, project support and engineering, procurement and construction management. And then they have Transnet property, which supports Transnet by optimizing and diversifying Transnet's business portfolio through growth in existing and new markets. So Transnet challenges. Similar to the other entities, they also had some mismanagement and ineffective governance processes and internal controls. This speaks to the qualified audit report. Because if they didn't have these issues, they would have a unqualified audit report. Then they have low economic growth impact on Transnet's business revenue and operations. So how it works is if the mining companies aren't producing, so they usually have a rail from the mine to the depot or to wherever they're taking the coal to. So that's Transnet. Transnet transports the coal from wherever, or if it's manganese to wherever, or whatever they're transporting from the companies. So if that company is not producing, Transnet is not transporting anything. So that affects the businesses. Delays in the capital program, procurement, and escalation of costs. So Transnet also had a market demand strategy, which was their capital program. So the MDS was basically, they downscaled it due to the economic slowdown. So they didn't want to overinvest. But they wanted to invest to create opportunities for business, but they didn't want to overinvest. So they scaled down their capital program. And then escalation of costs, it's the same also. And then the dual role of Transnet, this is a policy issue. The dual role of Transnet regarding oversight, which is the National Ports Authority, as well as being a player in the market, which is port terminals. So it's like themselves oversighting themselves, because they both fall under Transnet. Then high port charges. There was always complaints that the port charges was high, and I know that the Competition Commission was supposed to look into this, but I don't think they haven't given us a report on if this is true or not. Then, again, uncertainty in the energy sector, which will affect gas and pipelines business. This is, again, policy within the energy sector, because Transnet obviously has the pipeline where they transport the gas and the oil, and that also NERSA also regulates that, the tariffs with regards to that. So that's also an issue. And that is the end of my story. Thank you.
Honorable Shabalala is proposing a 5-minute break. Can we just to stretch?
The experts in wind and solar, they say it's cheaper.
Then the other thing is as a community, we need to raise that thing sharply.
We can have a few minutes because it's long time ago.
Yeah,
I was not quite sure.
I was trying to be quick.
No, it's the first round, don't worry. We'll get another round.
That's what I was saying. Everybody's saying detail, and I'm like, if I go into detail, we're gonna be here all day. Especially with Danelle, there's a lot of detail in Danelle alone.
It sounds like
I don't know what it's like.
No, we're supposed to.
We're going to open.
No, we cannot.
You cannot.
No, we cannot. That one.
That one you need to fight a political.
No, that one will tell you that it is going to keep. Yeah. We will travel with. We have to, no, we have to travel with.
It's our state enterprise.
I tell all of us, we must always travel on SAA.
Yes.
You know, that thing used to happen.
Because you are saying it has a problem. How will we support?
And then SAA must go to the
central
government. No. At all. It's our case. Advocate
on behalf of SAHS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You must go to
and
you
have to tell them
on their behalf.
I'm gonna leave it there. And inform you officially. That's the challenge we're
having. No, you don't have to discuss it in front of my zone.
But the thing is now my your check is going to be pretty good.
No, we don't want to
see
that.
You're going to oversee SAE, but
no, we don't.
No, we don't want.
We need to make a setup.
Not all about me from, because I'm from Nambobo, it's only SAE.
You see what happened is that the National Security has to have a resolution.
Or
could
be
an idea. So now they've rejected you.
Yeah, I think the Competition Commission, they wrote against that regulation, but the fact is that politicians need to check in terms of policy and act. You see? Because it does not make sense. You are saying you're overseeing something that is struggling and dying. But you don't use it.
It means it's not fair for other people to
use
it.
Yeah.
That's why you can't even use it.
Yeah?
Yes, it's open. You know, when I think it's
really
in the mind. It's a working lunch.
Yeah, I should have said that.
Yeah, working lunch. When they took up the car.
No, she's a cover the whole lunch.
Yeah.
Thanks for your presentation. It was a nice one. And all that.
Sure.
Thank you so much. But if I may ask, who was taking the decision to sell all the diamonds or to SSI or to take the original company to the other smaller companies and that company is making loss? Because is it a minister or the board members?
The managers.
Board members.
The management.
The
management. It's a
management,
yeah.
Oh. But what is the minister saying? It was right for the minister to take that decision.
No, it's not saying, can I just... She's saying it's not the minister that took that decision.
Hmm.
In actual fact, it's the management.
Management.
Operational management, or the management that runs the entity.
Okay.
And then the minister was asked by the portfolio committee, the fifth parliament,
yes,
towards the end of the fifth parliament,
mm,
to investigate.
Yeah.
I think as a committee, we suppose when we meet with the minister, with the department or the minister,
mm,
seek that particular information to be to be presented here, or to have an access to the outcomes of that investigation, so that we can be in a position to pave the way forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Kumar.
Chair, it looks as if reports that are very much taunting don't serve before, let's say, committees or serve there, like the AFS. You know, you can't have outstanding for years, and that's not submitted. Right? It looks
can,
like.
Sorry, can you press for your voices? Software.
So, in playing that, I was never so sure.
Yeah.
I'm trying to say, in light of what the honourable colleague is saying, why can't the minister appoint a specialized person to go there and have all this assessment and have the right price at which that gold will be sold at?
Diamond
runner. Because that's the only way out. You can't have it fluctuating and the community is complaining and no one comes with the right answer. But an independent kind of a person appointed by an independent, well, I hope the minister may be viewed as a person who is independent, appoint a specialist who will then work on this thing and then submit. Because that person would have gone perhaps around and find out what could be the ruling price of these things and then be recommended before the committee.
Yeah, I think that is what the minister is planning on doing, because he did appoint the investigation into the prices, so that is what is being happening at the moment. It's just that we haven't gotten feedback as yet, but that is what's being done at the moment.
There is something that spoke about 10-year lease. Who determines 10, why not 5, why not 100, why not something like that? Why is it married to 10?
That's with regards to Alex Gore. I think the 10 years, because Alex Gore needs to exit the, with regards to the deed of settlement, they need to exit the 51%. So they wanted to give him a period of time over which they can, I think, devise a strategy of how they're going to exit. So I think that's why they did the 10 years. But yeah, that was up to them to decide, I think, what the lease period between Alex Gore and the community. I think it can be looked at, I'm not entirely sure, but that I think it was an agreement between the community and Alex Gore.
Still on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I was under the...
Why don't you just ask all your questions?
Yeah.
This is what I'm trying to do. I was under the impression that whether gold, diamond or what is being polished somewhere not here in South Africa. Are we now polishing it here in South Africa? Because that's what we've always been saying, that if that can be done here, it will help us then employ more people, because that's where work is done. The community infighting, who facilitated the establishment of committees? I think that's where highlighted with you, Chair, that the late submissions of the AFS is a great concern. It's definitely a great concern. Yeah, I think that's late. Thank you, Chair.
Okay,
we do, Alexco does have a beneficiation where they're supposed to do the diamond, polishing of diamonds is called Maislak, but it's on a very small scale. It's only for Alex Gore diamonds, and I don't think that, I'm not sure what the current state of Maislak is at the moment, because there was a time when they were polishing the diamonds, but I'm not sure, they don't speak about it in the annual reports anymore.
Mm.
So it's definitely something that we need to follow up on. The community infighting, why is it not, at the moment now, the department decided to step in to oversee, and the Department of Rural Development also decided to step in to oversee this creation. But what the issue is with the creation is, even when it is supposedly created, when it's created, then a sector of the community will come and they will contest the creation. Because they will say, we weren't taken into account, we didn't vote for this person, they don't represent us. So there's always issues around. So even when people oversee the creation of the CPA, there's always community members that's not happy with it. So there are always contestations around this creation of the CPA. And then with regards to the AFS delays, the statement itself is there. It's just that the auditors won't sign it off because the issue is regarding the going concern. So if the company is not able to generate enough revenue to be able to look after itself, it's a going concern issue. Then basically, if they don't have money to run themselves, the company basically needs to close down. And if that's basically what they're saying. So if they do say that, then basically Alex Gore and SAFCOL and ESCOM and all, they have to close doors. And obviously we can't allow that to happen. So that's why the AFS is outstanding, because the auditors won't sign it off until they're in a position where they have enough money to make the auditors comfortable enough that they are going concerned. And then they will sign, and then they can only submit their annual financial statements. So until that situation is, that's why until their financials is strong enough, they won't be able to submit audited AFSs. They can submit unaudited ones, but not the audited AFS.
Honourable members, I just wanted to make a few inputs. I think from the presentation of the researcher, it has also become clear that at some point we also need to look at the legislative impediments that hampers all the state-owned enterprises in terms of the work that they do. Some of the SAA, say for example, SAA, they had mentioned to the committee before that one of the things that is their thing is that in the past, they used to get a share of the passengers, quite a bigger share of the passengers within the domestic market. for main airline. But and then the Competition Commission, I think the National Treasury also had like a guideline that says that government departments must use SAA so that the airline should be able to be afloat and to have that thing. But later on, the Competition Commission says, no, you cannot use SAA, there must also be British Airlines. But as you speak now, British Airlines has taken the bigger share of SAA for the domestic market. Even the airline you're going to be using for the oversight to leave is British Airlines, British Airways for some of the members, because the PFMA says that you must have strict codes. So the British Airways will get always a lower price. That is what is happening. The second issue is the issue of the ESCOM. I wanted to say that one of the things that ESCOM has complained with is that Lee spoke about, is that the IPPs, they sell electricity to them at 22 cents per kilowatt hour. And they sell the electricity back to the consumer at 98 cents, actually 89 cents in the last financial year. And then in this financial year, it's going to be 98 cents per kilowatt hour. So it means the IPP, they sell the electricity at more than 100% more than what ESCOM has to sell it. Hence the thing. But ESCOM does not decide whether to take IPPs or not. It's informed by the
Energy
Department. So the Energy Department is the one that puts an allocation in terms of how much IPPs must ESCOM take. And also on the issue of the electrification. The ESCOM does not decide how many houses to electrify. It's the Department of Energy that decides that this is the budget and this is how much you must spend or how many houses you must the target for this year for electrification. It's not ESCOM that takes that decision.
Well,
thank you, Chair. Let me start by saying, look, I think this is quite fruitful. Just it's unfortunate the program of it limits us to really go to detail in terms of discussion. So it's going to be helpful to discuss each and every entity for a certain time. But let's just welcome and appreciate the work that you've put in to give us this information. Clearly we need more. So I'm just going to make a couple of perhaps suggestions for this workshop purposes as we move forward for consideration in the program of the committee. Things that perhaps might be general and applicable to almost all of them that one might have highlighted as things that we need to take. Look, let me just start with the last part that you make on legislative imperative. I feel that the shareholder management bill, it's needed and it's immense. Perhaps we need to put it in our program as part of the interaction with the department itself, for them to really come and give us timelines around that, but also highlight the issues of, like you were saying, the common stockholder, so that we're very clear which ones do we have, the common stockholder or shareholder on shares that we own, our roles, I think it's very important, but also the rights of the common shareholder, I think it's quite important, including voting powers, ownership, for us just to really understand how we really come in terms of our shareholder. So that's one. Secondly, the stakeholder invitations, I support Ryan Dade Gumede talking about invitations. I feel that we need to invite stakeholders and listen, but specifically whether it's economists, specialists in each and every SOEs, just for them to come and share what they feel around certain SOEs that are responsible, they specialize in. AFSS submissions are quite imperative as well for us to call up one in all this, because we really need to get a grasp of it. Community participation invite. I will strongly suggest that in the committee program we look into going to those community as part of an oversight. Our role and responsibility, we can do public participation around that and see how we can intermediate in between those things and just hear what are the issues with regards to the two parties involved. suggest that we look into oversight and be there and call upon those communities on both sides. Inviting of all SOEs, I make submission that we need to invite all of them to a certain day of the portfolio committee. We can look into inviting to the portfolio committee so we can really interact with them in depth in all the issues. So they, and when we do that, can we invite the interdepartmental policy departments to form part of those? If we're looking into ESCOM, can invite energy as well. They can send a representation so that we're able to speak to the matters that will be coming. So each and every, whether it's the NEL, just invite the interdepartmental policy unit that is responsible for it, and that we will be killing two birds with one stone. That's my submission, I think.
Any more contributions? Kwanase?
I want to emphasize and support immediate timelines of shareholders management bill. I think for me, part of all the challenges, it should affect us a lot. But also, I'm the one who raised the issue of more information. I really appreciate the presentation, and after that, I think, yeah, it has improved. So we need more meat. yeah, but I have only two questions for David, Chair. One is on the panel, that is page 19, from 18. Can you please repeat for me in a very simple way the issue of a strategic partner for skills, technical transfer, local gender, around that? I think it will help me. But also on page 25, you talk about IPCs, which are the code, the price, and the separation of trade functions. And you talk about the advantages in the current situation. If you can just and clarity clarify more around that. Chair, on the last one is on page 32 on the FAA. The introduction of more airlines, what is it that is doing to our own on the mission journey? to our own, yeah.
Okay.
That would be my current interesting question. Thank you.
Yeah, you've got less than 8 minutes to answer all these long questions.
Okay. I understand the comment about more information. When we meet with the department, when I do the brief before that meeting, it will be the long, in-depth version. Then we'll get all the information. What I was talking about with regards to the NAL strategic partners is that they have shares in companies, but to a lesser extent. So they'll own maybe 49%, so they're not the majority shareholder on that company. But they have access to all information as a shareholder of that company. So if they want to know more about, say, optical solutions, or so to do maybe night vision, something on night vision or something like that, and they don't have the expertise. And this company that they have shares in are experts in this area. It's basically, then they will go there and maybe get the IP from this company because they're shareholders. And then also because not only the intellectual property rights of that technology, they can send their employees there to that company so that they can get the skills and maybe work there for like 3 or 6 months and then bring that information back and use it within the NAL. That's what I'm talking about with strategic partners. And with regards to energy, with regards to the
what was the East Mobile, but basically what they're talking about now is the separation. Because ESCOM does everything now. They do the generation. So generation is basically they build the power plant and they generate the electricity. They do the distribution. They see what the levels are and they'll send them. They control the load shedding basically. They're the ones that control that. And then the transmission, where they send it out to everybody. So basically they want to separate those three services, the generation, the distribution, and the transmission. So with the generation now, they want to make the generation more competitive. So once it's separate, then ESCOM won't be the only one building power plants and stuff. Anybody that maybe gets a license will be able to generate electricity. So that means it will free up the IPPs. Okay, and then with regards to the competition of SAA, they're blaming competition on how they're performing, because with a lot of low-cost carriers, people obviously now move away from business from the SAA flights to the cheaper flights. So more with the Kalulas or with the Fly SA, because it's cheaper to fly, it's no frills, they just want to get where they are. They don't need the SAA service that has the airships and everything. So now they may be struggling to be more competitive because now their prices are higher than the low-cost carriers. So now they don't have enough people in the planes to make up for, to cover all their costs. So that's how the competition is impacting on SAA.
Honorable members, we have only 30 minutes left for one. And I think we were the most ill-disciplined committee members here. We continued disrupting the previous input, and that made a very long presentation. I will ask now Mr. Mnisi to take as little as possible minutes in his presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is focused on government, and I don't know. We discuss the snapshot of the economy. The Board of Directors, National Practices, and reporting on performance to Parliament. Well, the slides are not numbered, so the one growth in incomes and labor productivity has stagnated since the credit crisis. So this is a global phenomenon where income and labor productivity has declined, and I think South Africa has also taken to it with our recent unemployment or employment figures, labor figures, and the GDP per capita remains 25% below the average of the upper half of the OECD countries. The organization, now the economic development, cooperation and development countries, so we remain weak in terms of our performance. And then the labor, we have got a weak labor utilization. So these are generally environmental issues, economic issues that are affecting our economy. But in the core, we also have inequality and poverty, and then environmental issues such as the gas emissions are below, but then the air pollution is high. So this is where green energy and renewable energy is coming into play, because that's where like ESCOM is the biggest polluter and that also misses environmental targets. And most discussions around coming with alternative cleaner energy is coming into play. So it will affect investment, I think, in the coal sector and also in the utilization of plants. We might see a complete move from traditional energy sources to cleaner versions of energy. And removing barriers to competition and lifting regulatory restriction in the sector will boost growth. So there are barriers in the economy. So others are saying that to have a monopoly in the sector, your state-owned entities such as electricity or energy have a state as a monopoly needs to change, so to allow others to participate. The airline is another area that there are barriers, and also just small and medium enterprises at a very low level locally, there are barriers to entry into the market. To set up a business has so many restrictions and red tape. And then I think another area that we're dealing with is the area that improving management and governance of state-owned companies and strengthening the regulation of network sectors crucial to ease supply-side bottlenecks. I think this analysis looks at how state-owned companies can be improved in terms of their governance and also strengthening the regulation of network sectors that govern them. Because when you talk about what Lee was talking, was presenting, if you looking at industries that Transnet is a transport provider or logistics provider solution, but it's entirely owned by the state. So the bottlenecks around that can unlock the value in terms of mines, in terms of mining industry, in terms of oil and gas sector, in terms of other sectors that are dependent on Transnet for logistics and support. And obviously the productivity of ports would also be improved because of that. So state-owned enterprises are not only providing services but also products. So how they are governed has a way in terms of allowing the players in the economy to participate. Load shedding was one area or that affected many businesses, and the ability to set up even at the basic level, an industry require huge amounts of electricity availability. And over the years, what we've seen is that there has been a decline in terms of a electricity availability factor in South Africa. So improving on the governance of that SOE has an impact in terms of how industry can come to invest in South Africa, can unlock those levels. But then another area is that the infrastructure needs to be improved, and we need to reduce intra-regional trade barriers to facilitate the flow of goods and people and increase market access and support economic growth and well-being. And then that means that our regional networks, because when we look at South Africa as a region, it's a region, especially from a shipping point of view, where the Dutch came in. Historically it has a strong regional presence in Africa, and anyone would want to expand into Africa to create business and trade, and South Africa has got that, you know, aspect of mobility. So to unlock value within SADC or within the African or, you know, the BRICS and all that, we have to find ways in terms of improving the infrastructure and reduce those barriers of trade. Some barriers are at a level where, you know, state-owned enterprises play a role, and then red tape to entrepreneurship that would help to unlock employment and productivity growth. I think based on that analysis, I think mine is just to go directly to where we'll be dealing with governance, and what I picked up at a very basic level is because as members, you will be interacting with the executive of, so it will be the CEO and the executive management and the board. So those are the ones that would, whenever we provide the role, or you provide the role of oversight, you'd be interacting at a, on a daily basis with. So I said, what are the national practices for the board of state-owned enterprises? So what they're saying is that the board plays a central function in SOC governance and should act as an intermediary between the ownership function. So the ownership function is the state's function and the department and the SOC executive department. But the state ownership function is discharged through the department or the ministry and the NDA. So the board is that intermediate that plays at that three-layered phase and stage to facilitate that there is a relationship between those three areas that interface. And it's founded on, it should be clearly defined and founded in legislation, preferably according to general company law. So how boards are founded, they are founded based on the principles of the company's law of South Africa, which is the Companies Act, and also another area of legislation and interface is the PFMA, the Public Finance Management Act, and I think the mandate that the act that establishes a particular SOC, and then it focuses on strategic guidance and corporate performance and the shift from traditional conformance role. So the traditional conformance role would be to checklist and to have a board that says we are attending meetings, we are here in the company as and when required. And then there is no control, there is no leadership, there's no sustainability, and there's no concerted effort in terms of understanding what is the need, where is the company going and how is it performing. So those are some of the things that the board should focus on. And the state should inform the board. So the state has a responsibility through the Shareholder Management Act. So in the establishment of the board gets into a contract, which is a performance contract, that between the state-owned company and the minister. So that is provided in the framework of what is called the Shareholder Management Act. and to guide performance. So, and the state outlines the priorities to the board in terms of what will be the focus areas of that board, and how, what are the proper channels of autonomy and independence, because we'll, and then so the second area is the nomination framework. So it should be transparent and is consistent in, and consistent in its application. The minister has the ultimate responsibility or executive power, and this brings legitimacy to the process. But it should not undermine the role of the ownership function. Well-visible boards should be subject to coordination or consensus on the on a whole government basis. So boards, even in wholly owned associates, should be entrusted in annual, so they are appointed in the annual general meetings of shareholders, and establishing a transparent and consistent method is to identify applicants from a wider pool, so and bring uniformity in the assessment process. But what we've seen over the years is that the nomination process as to who goes into the board of SOCs hasn't been transparent. But what we have been told was, you have to get an application. It's advertised to the so those who want to be nominated, there's an advertisement going out in papers, and then based on that, a list is created, and then people are interviewed, and it's a transparent process. But that hasn't happened. So I think this one is a way and a framework in which a nomination process should be followed. And then the board composition, it's persons directly linked with the executive power should not sit on SOC's board. So meaning that department, anyone who is linked with a political head or be working in the department does not sit directly in the SOC board. Other state representatives should be nominated based on qualifications, subject to vetting process. And then independent directors, which are board members, should be independent from management, governance, and business relationships. So that to avoid conflicts of interest. So specific safeguards should be established to verify that nominees comply with the requirements. So employee representatives, such as members of unions, and can enrich board discussion. So the appointment process should ensure that such these employee representatives are qualified as well, can also be included in the process. So certain eligibility requirements may be needed, but good practice increase the rely on tailored approaches to identify the right mix between skills, experience, and personal characteristics. So the composition of the board continued for all other direct ownership representatives. The relevant commercial and financial expertise is used as essential qualifications. Reasonable limits on maximum number of board appointments are important to ensure that directors have sufficient time to carry their duties. Diversity may add value to boards but should not rise to the level where the ability to attract candidates with the right skills and capabilities is imperative. Restricting board members to nationals should be limited to cases where there is demonstrated need for such rules, and considering that it can act as a barrier to attract the right talent. So the other section deals with induction programs for board members, and then but then says that to match the needs of the board, and then general training for board of the should not be a formal requirement. And then the third aspect, I think, deals with remuneration. So this is where I think we also challenge it in terms of the remuneration of board members and the remuneration of it's not a transparent process of executives. So the department at some point has promised to present the remuneration standard, and then I think it was said that it was tabled in the cabinet and abroad with DPSA and all that, the consultant will come up to say how are executives of SOCs remunerated and how are board members remunerated, because there is fluctuation in terms of who earns how much and where are they sitting. So what is the standard? But then a recommendation is that the board remuneration should reflect the market conditions to the extent that is necessary to attract and retain the highly qualified director. And then the remuneration policy of civil servants on associate board should be carefully considered to ensure the right of employees. So those are some of the issues. And then the boardroom efficiency. So the key to the board efficiency is the chair who can build an effective team by exercise and leadership, diplomacy, and a deeper understanding of business. So I think coming from where we were in terms of board performances, if you look at the board of Denel, the board of Eskom, the board of other boards within the portfolio, without mentioning and going into detail, were challenges in terms of how they have performed. And when it came to certain issues like your leadership skills and understanding of the business was lacking in terms of how the business is directed. And the question becomes, to what extent does the committee have power to influence this process or to get to the minister to say how do we unlock value within these SOCs, because everything rises and falls around leadership. So specialized committees can contribute to efficiency, but should not detract from the responsibility. So you in the board, you have committees that are doing work, but it depends on in SOCs. So you'd have an HR committee, an audit risk committee. You'd have all these specialized committees that support the work of the board, even tender committees in some, they call them investment and finance committees, where they make decisions, are constituted and headed by board members. But then they have a responsibility to do work that will inform the board, but then the board is the ultimate decision maker. So board committees shouldn't be made out of independent technical district board members to ensure efficiency. And then based on so I've got board evaluation. So based on the shareholder compact and the performance agreement that the board has with the minister, an evaluation process is conducted. And to ensure that that is happens successfully, it should not be limited to ticking boxes. So sometimes when it comes to performance, we also need external facilitators and some sort of a tool that we have to agree on to say, you have a board, you have this company, and going forward, what is it that you would be using as a tool to measure how this board and how this company performing. I think when I talk about the subject of governance, it's a wide, but then it's based on three issues: on sustainability, on being a good corporate citizen, but also on the I think essentially it's on leadership. But then there are also a lot of issues related to how we can interpret it. But for the purposes, I think, Chair, of time and this presentation, I think I should limit it to this one. Because the other one, it's information that members can work with. But it basically deals with processes of how departments report to Parliament. I don't know if I can continue or I can I'll leave it to that. It deals with financial statements, deals with the information, ensuring that the timing and reporting. There's an issue that I think was raised by me to say that FAA hasn't reported since 2016 and 17. And one area that when they were not reporting, would ask the department, would ask the entity. But then in a formal sense, we're not informed in terms of where the entity, what's happening, and what are the issues. So it talks about those issues. It talks about how information should come to the committee and when it's debated. Even this act that was adopted, the act that deals with the appropriation of $59 billion to ESCOM. So how is the committee informed by the ministry that there is this submission, and this submission is for X amount for a bailout, and so it comes with those recommendations, because we know that money has been appropriated to ESCO, but then what are the technicalities? What is the turnaround strategy? How are these issues going to be tabled and drilled to detail to say the restructuring office, or what will be the role of a restructuring office? What are the terms of reference in terms of that? So it talks about reporting, it talks about ensuring ad hoc reporting as and when. So basically it's broad, because we might limit it to one SOC. And then I said, let's just look at what are those issues. And thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nisi, for your presentation. Okay, we will have to engage Honorable Shabalala.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Which one is the company that cut out the trees? ASCO.
ASCO.
No,
SAPCO.
At some point, I heard we were supposed to stop cutting trees because of paper. Something like that, isn't it? We're not supposed to. We're not cutting up the trees.
Not for paper.
Not for paper purposes, for other things. All right, so this paper is sufficient. One thing, so it's because the document is so big, and I can see this empty spaces. So perhaps it could have been very smaller. State ownership rights. Chairperson, it's very clear there's been serious, I think, gaps. I'm just wondering now that over time in the new government, that we didn't see this when we did public enterprise as a department. Because the first thing you need to deal with, it's the legislation that governs this thing. Now, it's very bleak insofar as the shareholders' rights with the company itself that are created by the state. Now, it creates a final line and a thin line insofar as accountability is concerned, and that's what I'm capturing in your document. that you're giving us, that the challenges that we're citing here, be it when you speak about the board issue, because we are speaking about the role of boards, but when you look into all these things, it speaks about the role of the board should be clearly defined and founded in the legislation, preferably according to general company law. My question becomes, as you said, this company law that they decided, this is where it's going to be. But I'm just saying, when we speak about parliament accountability, and this is what we're citing, for me, the problem. It is a serious problem. And I want to go on. You also cite around nomination issues of people who must serve in the board, and you are citing where feasible board appointments should subject to coordination, consensus. The question becomes, where is the law governing this appointment? If we're going to cite the full documentation and you speak about the process and what needs to happen and how it must happen, can we lift the law that speaks to that? Then we're able to, because we're legislators, we're lawmakers. So that's my concern. It goes on, it says the board should involve in the nomination process an advisory capacity, but we're speaking about the same board that must be appointed. Now it must also serve. So for me, I feel there's some contradictions that I'm just getting in this document. It says persons directly linked with executive powers should not sit on the SOC boards. Other state representatives should be nominated based on qualifications. Such, like I said again, where is the law that governs? So that we're able to understand, when you say the executive powers, who are you talking about? Is it a person? Is it the ministry itself that should not sit? What is the current state of affairs right now? Are they sitting? And if you think they should not sit, what permeates that from a research point of view for the purposes of this committee? You don't have to answer now. You can just note them. Remuneration policies on civil servants. You're speaking on remuneration of it. The question is still the same. Where is the remuneration? And how are they getting remunerated? Based on the company, inflation, like you're saying, it seems not to be coherent or consistent with the law itself, because you're suggesting that we must carefully consider the right incentives. Based on what? Are they employed by government? Board committees should be made up of independent and technically literate board members to ensure efficiency. It's again the same point. And you speak about reporting on timing of reporting. Now, Chairperson, this issue on financial statements, and Honorable Swart, perhaps you can also assist us from a finance point of view, because throughout the day we're getting the issue of financial statements not being submitted, and reporting lines, accountability, it seems to be a problem. Now, the question that I have, financial statements are tabled in Parliament. This usually has to be done within a specific time frame. Looks like we are also not too sure, as this committee, when should they be. Where's the treasury regulations? Are they not used in this instance? So it goes back to this shareholder management bill. At what point do we come in? But the fact that there is public funds injected in these SOEs, clearly the PFMA would have to apply. But we're sitting the whole day and we're told that financial annuals are not submitted. So why did we do the annual performance plan as a department? If the department doesn't have an oversight fully role to really oversee these things, what have we done? Because for me, remember, these are things and these are regulations. We are going to empty PPS. So you ask yourself, at what particular point do we come in and what information? And Chairperson, what I've gathered here is that there seems to be some independent role SOCs or SOEs have, and the department final line for them to be able to come in. So I'm right on the oversight role, because the document speaks about Parliament not getting information. At times the interaction it has with SOEs is limited, or how they report is kind of quasi. So I have a concern with it. as we move forward to this, and I think for me it's things that we can just highlight and see as challenges. Perhaps we might not give response right now, but the sooner we can have the ministry and the legislation part of it, then we can be able to move on. So that if there's been things that have been left and not been attended to, and we need to start there if we're going to do a proper oversight role. You said it when you started in Tumi that we can, Parliament has got the right to summon anybody before it. Now, if we can do a full oversight, we need to know what are the rights of this SOEs and what is our right. To what point we can really stop? This is questions that we might not answer now because of the issues of time. But as we craft the programs and Chairperson's office and management deals with the systems thereof, you can be able to better put it. But the finance part, Honorable Swart, you've been here, you've sat in this committee. Can you assist us on this reporting? Thank you.
Oh, you are responding to that?
I'm in your hands, Chair. I'd like to ask some questions as well, but it depends.
Okay.
If I very briefly,
yeah.
Chair, my apologies again for leaving. I was at the Chief Whip's forum. But just to answer Ms. Shabalala, Honourable Shabalala's question relating to the finances, I think that is a very pertinent issue. One of the concerns why, for example, SAA has not delivered their financials is because of the going concern problems. And if they were to insist on audited financial statements, they'd be found to be bankrupt.
Mm.
So it had to depend on bailouts being given by Treasury. And so that is the situation. But it is for us as an oversight body to ask, well, why are you in that financial situation? And I think that is what the presenter was setting out from a governance perspective. And I think, Chair, just then, generally, just for me, having been involved in the ESCOM oversight, I think it would be helpful for members to look at that report because it is in ATC 28 November 2018 and makes a number of recommendations to improve this committee's oversight. And so it would be helpful to look at those and to what degree it was accepted by Parliament. And it does highlight that not only is the Companies Act applicable, but you've got the PFMA Act and the King Code on Corporate Governance, and of course you've got your Shareholders Compact and the Memorandum of Incorporation. Now we also need to bear in mind that the Zondo Commission might require us as Parliament to explain lack of oversight, and that the Speaker will deal with. So we need to really up our game as this Parliament. I think the ESCOM inquiry was a very good example of good oversight, excellent oversight. And where a lot of time was spent, a lot of resources was spent, and we might need to look at those recommendations that were made there. One of the concerns that I'd like to ask the presenter about, and that is the appointment of the boards. We saw that evidence. It is recorded. It's been filed again before the Zondo Commission. And that is abuse by the executive in the appointment of board members. And I think you made the point very well that the appointment process must be transparent, and that this Parliament should play a role in that. It is unacceptable for ESCOM, for example, that you had so many CEOs, so many boards appointed. Every time there was a new minister, there was a new board appointed. And it is clear that some of those board members were appointed to promote specific interests. And I think that, Chair, is very important for us to look into. So if you could just comment on that. I think the evidence that we got as well was that the role of the department played in... You mentioned advertising for board members, but there is a list drawn up in the department, and members are then drawn from that list. And I think Parliament needs to have a look at that process. How are board members appointed, and is it the best possible person for the job? So, Chair, I don't want to take too long. I know time is limited. We are starting with a lot of issues here, but just myself from a legal perspective, one of the recommendations we made was that if a board member is found to have been acted against the fiduciary duties of the company, he must be declared a delinquent director.
Mm.
That he can't jump from one to the next to the next. And those are some of the things that we can look in. The Companies Act makes specific provision for that. Thank you, Chair. And the last thing is that Shareholders Compact. I think, Honourable Shabalala, you pointed that out. When is the bill, the Shareholder Management Bill? That we need to insist That bill's been coming for some time, and that will help us understand the role of what we are dealing with. Thank you, Chair.
Matsumi, wanted to say something.
Yeah. No, I wanted to also respond to what Ms. Chabalala was saying regarding the issue of the absence of the what actually governs or gives effect to the behavior. And firstly, the PFMA is very clear in terms of the submission of annual financial statements, and I think it's by the end of August. Each and every year, all state-owned companies, the departments, all of them must submit. So they do submit. It's only the airlines that have had the problem over the years because of the COVID, the issue said, because, and they have written to the speaker and they were given approval for the years that they have not submitted. It's because they would be, they'll have to close shop if they submit the financial statements or they adopt them. They are basically bankrupt. It means the company must be closed in terms of the Company Act. And then the other issue is that the Companies Act is it gives the fiduciary duties. What is the role of the board? What is the role of the CEO? What is the role of the minister, the shareholder? In a normal circumstance, the shareholder will not be the minister, but in a private company, it will be people who own the company. So the Companies Act is very clear in terms of how to play the lines. And also the memorandum of incorporation. Yeah, the memorandum of incorporation you spoke about. The issue of the code of conduct, the King 4, the code of conduct of the thing, that one, it just gives us the principles of good corporate governance in terms of what is it that the companies or the boards must do and they can't do. So those principles are properly, it's a worldwide accepted code in terms of how boards must behave. So the South African government and private companies, we all use those principles. So those things are there, but the problem is how do we as oversight bodies enforce all those things? The Companies Act, the PFMA, the Memorandum of Incorporation, and the National Treasury Regulations. The National Treasury Regulations are the ones who tell the companies in terms of the usage of funds that have been disposed to them. So I think just to tell them that there is actually those things. There are those regulation and legislation.
Okay. Nobody want to... Okay. Sorry? Yeah, I want to make the point that everybody was it was final. But you can say something if you want. Even if, yeah, in case you didn't say it.
No, I think we've raised it, but sharply so. I wanted to understand on the remuneration of the board. Then, in the presentation, it reflects we need to attract, or the remuneration must attract. My question will be, what you are saying, we are unable to attract highly qualified because of the low salary, or it depends on the SOE, how do they remunerate? Do we have a circular, not a gazette, that says all SOEs must give their board members this much or what? So I need clarity on that, whether we have a gazetted thing or it depends on an SOE or whoever decides. As government, do we have such law that governs the remuneration? Because the way you have written it seems like there's a problem in attracting the right people to be appointed as board members. Thanks.
Can I make your life more difficult by being a bit controversial? A board is not running the entity. A board is just a governance. Why do you have to have, what kind of specific qualification you will need for a board? Well, to me, a board is just people. It's like in an institution of learning, you've got a council, you've got a, I heard it at some point, was at it's DOT at some point. I had the same argument with one of the professors there on the qualifications. They wanted to co-opt to that the thing is essential qualification. They wanted somebody who have some technical skills to form part of the board. And my question was, why do you have to need that person? Because it's governance. They are not running the faculties, they are not running the department. All what they are doing, they are foreseeing the institution that is following proper governance requirement. You know, perhaps when you...
I think it's easy, Chair, because the, I think I'll start with the issue of consensus. And I was thinking about consensus is the appointment by consensus, because the board of state-owned companies are appointed, actually the process is run through the ministry, but the ultimate decision is made by cabinet, and the chair of cabinet is the president. So the appointment by consensus, it means that it has to be vetted through all the stages, and it has to be debated through economic cluster meetings until cabinet decides on the appointment of board members and publishes it as the appointment of public of board members of an SOC. So that is the consensus, because there's a lot of consultation that happens around the process. But then the other area that you raised was that this person must not be linked to executive power. So it must not be someone who, because another area when we looked at, I didn't want to, it needs a session, and it needs a longer session of the whole, it needs a session. So to say, what are the areas that you've picked up in our own analysis of governance, especially in SOCs, and why there has been a decline? And then the recommendation to say comes as a result. But then these are, because when we look at the decline of SOCs was as a result of board compliance and board being close to executive power. So then there's a problem, because there is that relationship that conformance or compliance. So people just conform without understanding that there is an autonomy, the relationship, the political relationship. You need to understand the political direction and the priorities of government, but you need to have a broader view in terms of the understanding the commercial basis of how to run an enterprise. Because a board member, to answer your question, Chair, is actually not running the organization on a daily basis, but is a representative of the shareholder in the company, the shareholder being government and the South African people. So now when you are a representative of the shareholder,
you have what do you call it? Design,
what fiduciary duty? Fiduciary.
So you have fiduciary duties to discharge. So you have you have to provide strategy, and you have to provide leadership, and you also have to ensure that performance of the company or the enterprise is more successful. So the areas that require, I think that's where we go to highly skilled and financially literate and analytically, because we're dealing with numbers. So state-owned companies have got assets of more than R1 trillion. So when you have a huge responsibility to the economy, and one business has the ability to turn over billions of, so you need to understand the technical, what is the business about, what do they do, and you need to understand the structure of the business, the industry. Because one thing that can happen elsewhere globally can lead to art collapse. You need to understand how to read the financial statement. If executives come up with information as a board member, you need to understand what are they saying about maybe an operation or about whatever. If they present to say, we're going to let trading because of this aspect, then you need to provide direction and advise them, not advise them, but and point them in the right direction. Because the executive is also assessed in terms of their performance by the board. Am I right? So for you to assess someone's performance, you need to understand that person's work better than they do themselves. So I think that is just the, and then sometimes
remuneration.
Yeah, I've got challenges there. So on the so the practice is, I think, has been that at some point your attendance and allowance. So if you attend a meeting, you get an allowance. It could be 1,500 per meeting. It depends on at what level you are attracted to the company that you attend. So ESCOM has been in crisis. So board members were attending on a daily basis or longer than other organizations. So there's no, and then there are limits, but we don't know these limits. We don't know how much. So this information is not disclosed until later in the annual report. Yes. And the fees are not discussed upfront or presented upfront to say these are the director's fees. So maybe that information sits all with the department, but that information I think come through to understand what remuneration fees. Then I don't know if I've answered some of the questions, but then I'll just go to the one on nomination. So the nomination process hasn't been transparent over the years. We only told that the new board has been appointed, but then there are guidelines that were discussed, that were adopted before, but then somehow there's no advertisement that has been seen or people invited. So Mr. Swift is correct to say that a list has actually been
been populated, but we don't see who fits into the list, who was nominated by who, and how are these people drawn. Because and then the vetting process around the nominations. Because later, when we did the state, the committee undertook ESCOM's inquiry, it was found that most directors were what you'd call politically exposed persons. You see. So politically exposed persons were part of directorship of some of the entities. So these individuals were not supposed to sit in boards of SOCs, but then also others have had a very close relationship with the executive power. So it becomes a whole issue. That's why that in the recommendations, some of these issues are picked up to say we need to find the politically exposed police. And then I think it was in the last year's budgetary review and recommendations. And in terms of governance, the recommendations that we came up with to say what are the issues that the committee came up with, say what are the issues that need to be looked at. And then part of it, I think it has to do with transparency, because at the end of the day, the board has to be uncontroversial. It has to be far from controversial, and political interference, you know. So, and also has a bit of autonomy in terms of how they achieve the objectives. But so these are some of the issues, because if we need to find a way, Chairperson, I think to have the department provide us with what is the board nomination process, because that hasn't been, and what is the framework for their appointment of board members, and then following all these areas that was discussed. But that hasn't come through. But I don't know if it answers some of the questions. I think on the one that deals with delinquent directors, I think it's a recommendation that would be found, I think based on the process that are unfolding now, that some of the directors were complicit in their role, but then they didn't discharge those. And then if there are proceedings criminally or being pursued criminally, then it will be something that hopefully, based on the Zondo now, because yes, there is that recommendation, I agree with you that you have put that, but then I think it's something that is has to be subject to
Okay.
Yeah,
you done?
Yeah, I think it was just.
I think we can prepare something for you. I think we can prepare.
Okay.
Just one point. I appreciate what you're giving us. But I'm just saying, Chairperson, because I'm trying to listen carefully. I understand the BRR that you've highlighted this historically and what if you will go back and look. But we can't make statements on the appointment of boards and we say politically exposed person close to the executive, yet you told us by saying, well, ask the department to give us how they appointed them, but you've given an analysis that this is what you found. What you need to empower us as the research give us legislation that governs appointments of the board. Where is it found? And you will read it. From there, then we can allow you to make all these things. At least you would have empowered us. You don't have to give it, like I'm saying, give us that. And then that way it's easy. You've already made the reference. Then I can be able to say, make distinction. Because we can't say at the end, we're going to ask the department to give us, but you've analyzed the situation.
I am sorry to recommend on your behalf, but I think one thing is it's clear that the board appointment process is taken from the Companies Act.
Yes, thank you.
And then that is the legislation.
Thank you.
But then on good corporate governance, the principles come from hopefully whatever. But then it comes from the King report, the King report recommendation. The King.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, King Code.
Yeah.
And also the national guidelines are based on practices of SOCs in top performing countries in the OECD. So those are some of the things that have been adopted. And I can give you a source document to follow through on
Thank
these
you.
Issues. Because what we're saying, I'm sorry just to finalize this, we have a state that it is now, but then we have what we'd like to see in future. So this is our Rolls Royce. But at the moment, we're still driving our Mercedes Benz.
Okay. Thank you, honorable members. In that note of Rolls Royce, let us I wish to thank everybody that has made presentation here, and thank you very much for your assistance. We are in a learning curve, and we will be slowly grasping. I know the teacher, learning is a long-term process, it's not an event. We can sit here the whole day and try. The level of craft will be less than 20%, you know. Now, I'm happy when we go step by step, but the more we will end up being able to grasp and develop some confidence as we go through the process. Let's be patient, and at the end of the day, we'll see the fruits. Thank you, the members, honorable members, for coming, and also those who have left. We appreciate your presence here. Thank you, the secretary, including the representative of the ministry and the researchers from all angles. We thank you very much. The meeting is okay. Please, let me give the secretary to help us with the next week. We are aware that next week we are going to an oversight. Can you take us through?
Okay. Thank you very much, Sir President. Honourable members, we have taken a chance by ensuring that we take the members to an oversight. But actually, the first week and the second week were not meant for oversight, were meant for committee. Hence, there's still a discussion whether there's going to be a plenary next week, questions to the president, deputy president or not.
Okay.
It was cancelled now.
Okay.
So there's been that thing, because Ms. Mazzoni has been sending me email asking, why are you having oversight when there's a deputy president question? So we are taking that particular chance, knowing that it is an opportunity, because not always we get time to go out. So we thought it would be important for us to take the members to these companies, because they are operating in different sectors: defense, aviation, transport, logistics, forestry, and all of those things. So it's important sometimes for the members to have gone there to actually understand. Yeah. So the purpose of the oversight is to familiarize the committee with the operations of the entities in order to understand the capabilities of the entities, and also to enrich the understanding of the members. And seeing that we have had this particular induction, it will also build into that. And then we also looked at only being in one province, so that we are able to cover as many as possible with reduced traveling, because our companies are actually all over the country, but usually we spend more time on the traveling up and down than we spend less time on the oversight. But the approach we took was to choose one particular province, so that we are able to see a number of things that next time we look. One of the things that we wanted to check was the power stations, but because the power stations are actually outside of the Gauteng province, it will have to go through. We have to go probably in the next oversight visit. So we'll leave on Monday, which is the 26th of August. The flights are around 3 o'clock. Most of the flights around 4 o'clock. Yeah, 3 o'clock. Yeah, so, and then we will arrive at the in Gauteng on Monday, and then we are going to sleep at the Southern Sun Pretoria Central, in Pretoria Central in Arcadia. Then on Tuesday, we're going to meet with the department. But even up to yesterday, even this week, we've been engaging with the department and entities to see how best we can cover as much for the members, so that they can cover more. So even yesterday, they were still giving us more suggestions in terms of how to enrich our program so that we can get exposure. So we will have the meeting with the department, because the department was meant to give us a progress report on that has been made in terms of addressing the governance challenges in all the stakeholder enterprises, and then also the mechanism that they've introduced and the interventions to improve oversight over state-owned enterprises. And then also the walkabout was actually for the committee to actually see, because the department is an oversight department, so it's not a service delivery department. So I'm saying this because when the department comes here, they will tell you that the 3 DDGs that they had, the first DDG of transport went to transport to Transnet, the second DDG of transport went to Transnet, the third DDG of transport went to Transnet. So we have not had a DDG for transport. Every time they appoint somebody, Transnet takes, because Transnet pays 3 million rand or 4 million, and the DDG is earning 1.2 million. So same as energy. So it's one of the things that we thought that the committee needs to go and engage the people who are doing the oversight over state enterprises, whether they've got the capacity to do oversight. Because one of the questions that committee would ask is that, Where were you as the DDG or as the chief director when this company was doing all these things? Were you not doing oversight? Mm. And then they said, no, but sometimes we don't have power to do these things. We don't have the capacity to oversight. We don't get the info. So it's important for the committee to see who is the department, who are these people, who are, what do they have? Do they have the right skills? So it's one of the reasons that we want the committee to also engage, because the department has got a vacancy rate of 10%. Next. And the 10%, they cannot fill it most of the time because they are unable to get the skills to be able to oversee these technical companies.
Because of the market.
The market, for you to be able to oversee Eskom, for example, you must have you must be very skilled and highly qualified, because those engineers of Eskom, they've got 20 years experience, 30 years experience, and they are highly qualified. So it's important that the department must also be highly capacitated. After engagement with the department, we will be visiting Kuruspoor. And then the department, up until yesterday, they proposed that they will be able to also visit the Transnet National Operating Center. Yeah, it's in Germiston, eh? Parktown. That is where Transnet actually oversees the railway and the network in terms of, because Transnet is responsible for logistics of the country in terms of moving manganese from the Northern Cape to Saldanha to what to all of these things. So they would like to show us also that particular thing and the challenges that Transnet is facing in terms of operations and things. Then on Wednesday, we will visit Denel Pretoria Metal Pressings. Yes. Pretoria Metal Pressings, which is in Atteridgeville. And then after lunch, we'll visit the Land Systems. Those are two divisions of Denel, which are totally independent. They've got a CEO. Each one has got a CEO because they've got different capabilities. So the other one has got to do with thing, and we will be able to get exposed in terms of what are the capabilities that these people are doing, and how come they are not getting support from government. One of the reasons Denel is also actually suffering is because it doesn't get support from government, from the defense company, AMSCOR. AMSCOR does not make as much, does not order as much. It's supposed to, or even promote Denel as much as it's supposed to. So Denel is doing its own marketing, yes, and it's not taking as much work from Denel as much as it's supposed to. And then on Thursday, then because these ones are in Pretoria, we'll be staying in Pretoria Central. Then on Wednesday when we leave, we'll check out of the hotel. Then we'll check into OR Tambo Southern Sun, which is closer to the entities we'll be visiting on Thursday. Because on Thursday, we will be meeting SAA and South African Express Airways. The intention there was to meet both governance structures of SAA and South African Express Airways. Yes, but the thinking of the support staff was that we should actually, because it will be difficult to engage them in terms of their presentations there, because it will have to take the whole day, but rather the committee to engage, to look at how this whole thing is done. The SAA, because when we speak of airship, the committee needs to understand what is airship, what are the challenges, where is it exiting, what is happening within that particular space. The technical is where they do overall of the train, of the aeroplane. It's important to take the members there to see how does SAA do maintenance and speak to the people who are doing maintenance and find out what are the challenges of what is it, why is it, why does it take long to have an overall of a plane and get it back again, because there's always a shortage of planes. Then we take you to the baggage, because there's always the issue of lost baggages. The security of the baggage, there is a process that is taking place. There is companies that have been appointed to look at the baggage of people and oversee the baggages, but still the baggages get lost. So it's important for the community to have an intricate knowledge of what happens actually when you put your bag in before the aeroplane.
But don't start doing that here.
I'm trying to motivate why we put this thing here. Yeah. But the challenge now, the challenge is that SAA says because the overtime is so big, we might not be able to do all these things, like the baggage and what. They might be able to show us the technical, they might be able to show us the, an airship. The baggage, they were asking me that if it's possible on our arrival on Monday, if we're all there at the airport, we are able to all go through the baggage process. Then they take us through on Monday when we arrive at the airport at 5 o'clock. If everybody's there at the airport, for an hour, we all go, they take us through. So that on that day, when we do oversight, at least we have covered some. But if we all agree, I can speak to them tonight and then say that we're changing. Can you do some of the things already? Because the airport is very big. And then on Friday, we'll be doing the ESCOM Systems Operating Center, which is in Germiston. That is where ESCOM basically oversees the whole grid, electricity grid, in terms of where electricity is being generated and then where it must be distributed to. So that's where they look at that. They look at where the plants, how the plants are
behaving.
Yeah. performing. And then how electricity is being generated in the country and how the decision is taken to load shed and all of those things and why do they load shed. So all that information will be there in the particular national operating center. And then the department also proposed that on that particular day, we might be able to see another power station of the farm, the carbon, which is not far. It's also